Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
How did the people support the movie, like on the street level? What was the people's response to the movie?
Oh, man, they were standing around the block in the rain. We almost broke the box office record down at the Woods Theater when it opened.
Okay.
And only a James Bond movie drew more people.
Now, your film, was it featured in there, or was it a second movie that go like a duplex, or I mean a deluxe?
No, it was the only movie shown in the Woods.
Okay.
On the second go around, it was shown at the McVickers. But what happened is we started getting reports that exhibitors were being visited by FBI agents in an attempt to convince them of the danger of this film. In some cases, the film would open on Friday and close on Sunday.
Mm. Yeah, because it didn't really have long runs.
How long was that run? About just...
It was... on the market, hit and miss from Labor Day weekend 1973 until February of 74. That's when a delegation of the FBI met with the distributors, United Artists, who were not the producers. Ivan and I were co-producers. And they shut it down in February of 74.
And Black Hollywood didn't rally behind you? You know, Black Hollywood didn't try to support you?
Hell no.
Wow, man, what's wrong with black folks, man?
Come on, man. They didn't get to be making movies in Hollywood by doing the kind of stuff I do. Well, I'll take exception. It's not a little bit controversial. It is very controversial.
All right. Well, see, I'm trying to fly under the radar right now, but that's okay.
Well, I'm not politically correct.
Right, right.
You know, don't make no apologies for me.
Right.
What was the white media's response to it, like, or the military, especially when you have, you know, young black brothers, former gangbangers, but not revolutionaries, you know, going after the police and the army.
Well, Gene Siskel went up the wall, man. He
hated it.
He didn't give you a thumbs up?
See, now the book was largely ignored by the critics. And the government, I don't think, was too worried about that because to this day they think we don't read.
Absolutely.
All right. Wow. But when it became a movie, they know we go to movies. Mm-hmm. We make up 26% of the movie audience, although we only have 13% of the total population. So we're solid moviegoers. Mm-hmm. And that's when it became dangerous.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, September 16th, 2016, so I have been told. The audio clip you heard at the beginning of the program, that was a 2013 interview from Muse Man Multimedia, interview with the late author, director, filmmaker, Sam Greenlee, talking about The book we are beginning today, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. It was published as a book in 1969. The film came out 4 years later, 1973. We'll be grand to review this book with Cal's listeners. As I understand it, there are many people, just like what you heard in the audio clip just there, there are many Cal's listeners who have seen the film, but they have not read the book. They are very close. Sam Greenlee wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation, and he was intimately involved with the film project. So obviously they are very, very close, but there are some significant differences between the two. I will try to point those out as we move along with the book. But without further ado, we will get started. This is one of the few times that we do works of fiction on the program, but I would say similar to 2000 Seasons, this work of fiction reveals a lot of truth about racism, white supremacy. We will get started. I almost said the main character's name, Dan Freeman, but we will get started. This is Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door, audio segment number one, narrated by Gus T. Renegade. The Spook Who Sat by the Door by Sam Greenlee, published in 1969. Chapter 1. Today the computers would tell Senator Gilbert Hennington about his impending campaign for re-election. The senator knew from experience that the computers did not lie. He sat separated from his assembled staff by his massive, uncluttered desk, the Washington Monument framed by the window to his rear. They sat alert, competent, loyal, and intelligent with charts, graphs, clipboards, and reports at the ready. The senator swept the group with a steely gaze, gave Belinda, his wife, and chief aide a bright smile of confidence, and said, "All right, team, let's have a rundown, and don't try to sweeten the poison. We all know this will be the closest one yet. What I want to know is how close. Tom, kick it off." "The campaign war chest is in excellent shape, Chief. No major defectors." "Good. I'll look over your detailed breakdown later. Dick?" I spent a week on Madison Avenue with both the PR boys and our ad agency. They both have good presentations ready for your approval, Senator. I think you'll be pleased." "How do we shape up on TV, Dick? All our ducks in line?" "Excellent, Senator. You'll be on network television a minimum of 3 times between now and Election Day. Just about perfect. No danger of overexposure." "Have you licked the makeup thing yet, Dick?" asked Belinda Hennington. "A small detail, but it probably cost one man the presidency. We don't want that to happen to us." "No sweat, Miss Hennington. Max Factor came out with a complete new line right after that fiasco. I think we'll be using graying temples in keeping with our maturity image. As we all know, the youth bit is out nowadays. Fortunately, with the senator, we can play it either way." "Good show, Dick," said the senator. "Harry?" "I've run the results of our polls through the computers, both the IBM 436 and the Remington Rand 1401. Lewis Harris gave us a random pattern sampling with peer group Anchorage. Gallup, a saturation vertical syndrome personality study, and NORC, an ethnic and racial cross-section symbiology. The results check out on both computers, although I'm programming a third as a safety valve checkout. The computers have you winning the election, Senator, but by less than 3,000 votes. A small shift, and there goes the ball game." The senator, startled and troubled, glanced nervously toward his wife. She gave him a smile of reassurance. "Do the computers indicate a possible breakthrough," he asked, "with any of the peer groups? How do we stand with the Jewish vote?" "You're solid with the Jews, Senator. Where you're in trouble is with the Negroes. The Negroes? Exclaimed Senator Hennington. Why, I have the best voting record on civil rights on Capitol Hill. Just last year, I broke the ADA record for correct voting on civil rights with 97.64. Our polls reveal a sharp decline just after your speech requesting a moratorium on civil rights demonstrations. If we can regain most of the lost Negro percentile, Senator, we're home free. No use crying about a lack of voter loyalty. This calls for a think session. Perhaps we should have our special assistant on minorities and civil rights sit in, although I'm not sure how helpful he'll prove. Frankly, I'm disappointed by his performance so far. Judy, said the senator into his office intercom, think session in here. No calls, please, and cancel all morning appointments. And ask Carter Summerfield to join us, will you? The senator turned to his wife as they awaited the arrival of Summerfield. Belinda, I'm beginning to have serious doubts about Summerfield. He hasn't come up with a fresh idea since he joined us, and I don't expect anything other than tired cliches from him today. He's fine in a campaign, Gil. That's where he'll shine. I don't think you ought to rely on him for theory. Perhaps you're right. I guess it's not brains we're looking for in him anyway. No, she smiled. That's his least valuable commodity to us. The senator swiveled his leather-covered chair half round and gazed out at the Washington Monument. This question of the Negro vote could be serious. I never thought I'd ever be in trouble with those people. We have to come up with something which will remind them that I'm the best friend they have in Washington, and soon. Carter Summerfield had sat in his office all morning, worried and concerned. He sensed the senator was not pleased with his performance and could not understand why. Summerfield had sought desperately to discover what it was the senator wanted to hear in order that he might say it, and was amazed to find that the senator seemed annoyed when his own comments were returned only slightly paraphrased. In all his career as a professional Negro, Summerfield had never before encountered a white liberal who actually wanted an original opinion from a Negro concerning civil rights, for they all considered themselves experts on the subject. Summerfield found it impossible to believe Senator Hennington any different from the others. He had spent the morning searching for the source of the senator's displeasure until his head ached. The handwriting was on the wall, and Summerfield knew his job was at stake. He must discover the source of displeasure and remove it. Perhaps he should wear ready-made clothes. Had the senator somehow seen him driving the Lincoln rather than the Ford he had always drove to the office? It was essential never to have a more impressive car than one's boss. He told all his newly integrated Negro friends that. Had anyone discovered the encounter with the white girl in Colorado Springs when he had accompanied the senator on a trip to the Air Force Academy? He had been certain he had acted with the utmost secrecy and discretion. But he had known even then that it was a stupid move which might threaten his entire career. Summerfield took 2 Jellicils and a tranquilizer and reached for the phone to inquire discreetly of his fellow integrated Negro friends if there was word on the grapevine of an opening for a man of his experience. The phone rang. It was Senator Hennington's secretary summoning him to the senator's office for a think session. Smiling, as always when in the presence of whites, Summerfield entered the senator's office, his eyes darting from face to face for some sign concerning his present status. But the looks of the other members of the staff were no longer funeral, and the senator greeted him with a warm smile as he motioned Summerfield to an empty chair, briefly inquiring about his wife and children. "It seems, Carter," said the senator, "that we're in serious trouble with the Negro vote." Summerfield frowned in sympathy and concern. "We must come up with a fresh, dramatic, and headline-capturing act on my part, which will prove to my colored constituents that I'm the best friend they have in Washington." He swept the room again with his steely gaze, Gary Cooper back to the wall, but undaunted. "And we must do it today." Summerfield nervously licked his lips. "How about calling a conference of the responsible Negro leaders to discuss your new civil rights bill, Senator?" The senator considered for a moment. "I don't think so, Carter. To be perfectly frank, I don't think the bill will pass this session. White backlash." "How about a fact-finding tour of the African countries?" said Dick. "No, I did that last year and still haven't kicked the dysentery I picked up on safari and Tanganyika. How about a speech attacking apartheid at Cape Town University?" asked Harry. "I don't think South Africa would grant me a visa." "Gil," said the senator's wife, "why don't we accuse the Central Intelligence Agency of a discriminatory hiring policy?" "Segregation in the CIA?" "Yes, they have no Negro officers at all. Mostly menial and clerical help." "Are you certain, Belinda? This could be what we're looking for." "I'm positive, but I'll check it out. We have a man in personnel over there, you know." "Couldn't a charge of that nature prove counterproductive, Mrs. Hennington?" asked Dick. "CIA's almost as untouchable as the FBI." "Not since you two and the Bay of Pigs. And this should prove an irresistible combination for the press. Cloak and dagger and civil rights." "I'm inclined to agree, Belinda," said the senator, who was usually inclined to agree with his attractive wife. "What's the best way of springing this thing for maximum impact?" "Why not at the Senate Watchdog Committee hearings?" said Tom. "But the hearings are closed," said the senator. "It wouldn't be the first time we've used closed hearings for a press leak, Gil. I'll brief Mark Townsend over lunch here in the office on the day of the hearings," said Belinda. "Excellent," said Dick. "A political columnist of his stature is perfect. Now, how do I play it in the hearings? Indignant, angry, or do I underplay?" "Dignified, I think, Senator," said Harry. "You're shocked and saddened that the agency in closest grips with the forces of godless communism is shackled by the chains of racial prejudice." "Right," said Tom. "You say that America must utilize the talents of its entire citizenry, regardless of race, color, or creed, in the Cold War." "They'll deny it at first," said Belinda, "then probably claim their personnel files are classified, but they'll back down when they get enough negative press coverage. They're very image conscious nowadays." Carter Summerfield sat looking interested, but carefully silent, advising the senator how to criticize other whites was definitely not one of his functions. "I can program one of the computers to provide statistics showing the increased efficiency of the armed forces since their integration," said Tom. "If CIA does select a Negro, he'll be the best known spy since 007, said Harry. "Well, he will find it a bit difficult after all the publicity he's going to get," said the senator. "You mean, Gil," said his wife, "the publicity you're going to get?" The senator smiled. "General," said Senator Hennington, addressing the director of the CIA, "it has come to my attention that there are no Negroes on an officer level in the CIA. Would you care to comment on that? The other committee members looked at Senator Hennington with some shock. They knew he faced a close election in the fall, but this gambit was below the belt. The general, fighting to control his famous temper, replied icily. You know, of course, Senator, that our personnel files are highly classified. I'm aware of that, General, but this meeting is closed, and we are all cleared for that kind of information. It's not true that we don't have any colored at the agency. Our entire kitchen staff, our maintenance section, and drivers are all colored. My question, General, concerned Negroes on an officer level. Well, we don't have any colored officers. Do you think, General, that a policy of racially selective recruiting, which excludes a full 10% of our population, is a wise one? Yes. While I personally have no race prejudice, I feel Negroes are not yet ready for the highly specialized demands of intelligence work. Really? Said Senator Hennington, smiling a smile of patronizing pity into the face of bigotry. It's a question of sociology rather than prejudice. A gap simply exists between the races, which is a product of social rather than racial factors. There are Negroes who have bridged that gap. If so, I would welcome them in CIA. I would suggest you make more of an effort to find them. Senator Hennington, said the committee chairman in his rich, aristocratic southern drawl. We all know that deceit, hypocrisy, duplicity are the everyday tools of our agents in the field. Much to their credit, the childlike nature of the colored mentality is ill-suited to the craft of intelligence and espionage. I'm afraid, Mr. Chairman, replied the senator, once again entering into the charade concerning race he had conducted with his southern friend for well over a decade. I don't understand what you mean by the colored mentality. There is a question of cover, said the general. An agent must be capable of fading into the background, adopting the guise of the person one cannot remember minutes after meeting him. Negroes in the field would be far too conspicuous. General, I'd rather not carry this conversation any further. I would appreciate a report in a month's time concerning the progress of the establishment of a merit hiring policy at CIA. The luncheon table had been trundled away, and Belinda Hennington and the famous political columnist Mark Townsend sat in the conversation corner of the senator's office, sipping brandy from large snifters. Both the senator and I wanted to give you an exclusive on this, Mark, said Belinda. Thanks, Belinda. Are you sure this checks out? The government is supposed to be at the forefront in merit hiring. Not the CIA. We're positive. I have a man at the CIA. Mind if I check him out on this? Of course not. You can use an undisclosed CIA source in your lead. This could bring civil rights back into the headlines. It's been suffering from overexposure lately. You're right, Mark. The public has tired of the same old thing. Fire hoses, cattle prods, dogs on the one hand, and singing, marching, and praying on the other. Civil rights could use a good public relations man. When will the senator make an official statement? I should guess after the wire services and television pick up your beat. About 3 days, I should think. Sounds about right. Where will you conduct the press conference? Right here. The Washington Monument makes a good backdrop for the television cameras.
almost a Hennington trademark. Townsend had left, and Belinda was sipping a well-earned scotch on the rocks when the senator returned. She mixed her husband a drink as he sank into the leather chair behind his big desk. "How did it go today, dear?" she asked. "Couldn't have gone better, honey. I'm certain this is it." "Yes, dear. By this time next week, we'll have the Negro vote wrapped up again." She handed the senator his drink and rested one sleek hip on the polished mahogany of the desk. "Never take the voters for granted. Even Negroes react eventually, you know." "I'd have thought the CIA would have been more alert on a thing like this. If they'd had even one Negro officer, my charges would have fallen as flat as your sister's souffles. If it hadn't been the CIA, it would have been someone else. We're not likely to run out of institutions to accuse of segregation in our lifetime, darling." They smiled at one another affectionately. That November, the senator won his re-election comfortably, the Negro vote accounting for more than his margin of victory. Chapter 2. Freeman watched the class reunion from a corner of the common room of the CIA training barracks. It was a black middle-class reunion. They were black bourgeois to a man, black nepotism personified. In addition to those who had recruited themselves upon receiving notice that the CIA was now interested in at least token integration, five were relatives or in-laws of civil rights leaders, four others of Negro politicians. Only Freeman was not middle class, and the others knew it. Even had he not dressed as he did, not used the speech patterns and mannerisms of the Chicago ghetto slums, they would have known. His presence made them uneasy and insecure. They were members of the black elite, and a product of the ghetto streets did not belong among them. They carefully ignored Freeman, and it was as he wished. He had no more love for the black middle class than they for him. He watched them establishing the pecking order as he sat sipping a scotch highball. It was their first day in the training camp after months of exhaustive screening, testing, security checks. Of the hundreds considered, only the 23 present in the room had survived and been selected for preliminary training and constantly reminded of it since they had reported. They pranced, posed, and pruned in mutual and self-admiration. To be a Negro firster was considered a big thing, but Freeman didn't think so. "Man, you know how much this 12-year-old scotch cost me in the commissary? 3 bills and a little change." "Shivhead Regal. As long as I can put my mouth around this kind of whiskey at that price, I'm in love with being a spy. You know they call CIA agents spooks? First time we'll ever get paid for that title. Man, the fringe benefits. They just don't stop coming in. Nothing to say of the base pay and stuff. We got it made. Say, baby, didn't we meet at the Penn Relays a couple years ago? In that motel on the edge of Philly. You remember that chick you was with? Lurleen. Well, she's teaching school in Camden now, and I get a little bit of that from time to time. Now, man, don't freeze on me. I'm married, too. And you know, Lurleen don't give a damn. I tell her I saw you when we get out of here. Where'd you go to school, man? Fisk? I went to Morris Brown. You frat? Q? You got a couple brothers here. Those two cats over there. What you major in? What your father do? Your mother working too? Where your wife go to school? What sorority? What kind of work you do before you made this scene? How much bread you make?
Where's your home? What kind of car you got? How much you pay for that suit? You got your own pad or you live in an apartment? Co-op apartment? Tell me that's the new thing nowadays. Clue me in. You got a color TV? Component, stereo, or console? Drop those names. Doctors I have known. Lawyers, judges, businessmen, dentists, politicians, and great Negro leaders I have known. Drop those brand names. GE, Magnavox, Ford, GM, Chrysler, Zenith, Brooks Brothers, Florsheim, Johnny Walker, Chivas Regal, Jack Daniels, imported beer, DuPont carpeting wall-to-wall drags with split-level minds, remote control color TV souls, and credit card hearts. Play Who Do You Know? And Who Have You Screwed? Blow your bourgeois blues, your nigger soul sold for a mess of materialistic pottage. You can't ever catch Charlie, but you can ape him and keep the gap widening between you and those other niggers. You have a ceiling on you and yours, your ambitions, but the others are in the basement, and you will help Mr. Charlie keep them there. If they get out and move up to your level, then what will you have? They eyed Freeman uneasily. He was an alien in this crowd. Somehow, he had escaped the basement. He had moved up to their level, and he was a threat. He must be put in his place. He would not last, Breeding told, but he should know that he was among his betters. The tall, good-looking one with the curly black hair and light skin approached Freeman. He was from Howard and wore his clothes Howard style, the cuffless pants stopping at his ankles. His tie was very skinny and the knot almost unnoticeable. His shoulder padding non-existent. He had known these arrogant Chicago niggers like Freeman before, thinking they owned Howard's campus, moving in with their down-home ways, their Mississippi mannerisms, loud laughter, no manners, elbowing their way into the fraternities, trying to steal the women, making more noise than anyone else at the football games and rallies. One of those diddy-bop niggers from Chicago had almost stolen his present wife. Where you from, man? You don't seem to talk much.
No, I don't.
Don't what?
Don't talk much. I'm from Chicago.
Chicago? Where you from before that? Way back. Georgia. Snatchback. Mississippi? You look like you just got off the train, man. Where's the paper bag with your sack of fried chicken?
Freeman looked at him and sipped his drink.
Nah, seriously, man. Where you from? A lot of boys here from the South. How come you got to pretend? I bet you don't even know where State Street and the Loop is. How you sneak into this group? This is supposed to be the cream, man. You sure you don't clean up around here?
Freeman stood up slowly, still holding his drink. The tall one was standing very close to his armchair and had to step back when Freeman rose.
Baby, I will kick your ass. Go away and leave me the hell alone.
The tall one opened his mouth to speak. A fraternity brother sidled up, took his arm, and led him away. Freeman freshened his drink and sat down in front of the television set. After a lull, the black middle-class reunion resumed. He had not made a mistake, he thought. All niggers looked alike to whites, and he had thought it to his advantage to set himself apart from this group in a way that would make the whites overlook him until too late. They would automatically assume that the others, who looked and acted so much like their black representatives and spokesmen who appeared on the television panels, spoke in the halls of Congress, made the covers of Time and Life, and ran the Negro newspapers and magazines, who formed the only link with the white world, would threaten to survive this test. Both the whites and these sadiddy niggers, Freeman thought, would ignore him until too late. And, he thought, Whitey will be more likely to ignore a nigger who approaches the stereotype than these others who think imitation the sincerest form of flattery. He smiled when he thought about walking into his friend's dental office that day. "Hey, Freebie, what's happening, baby? Ain't seen you in the Boulevard Lounge lately. Where you been hiding? Got something new on the string?" "Nope. Been working." "Look, you know the cap you put on after I got hung up in the Iowa game? I want a new one, with an edge of gold around it." "Gold? You must be kidding. And where you get that refugee from? Robert Hall suit?" "That's where I bought it. I'm going out to Washington for a final interview panel, and I want to please the crackers." His friend nodded. He understood. Freeman did not spend much time socializing with the rest of the Negro pioneers, those chosen to be the first to integrate a segregated institution. He felt none of the gratitude, awe, pride, and arrogance of the Negro firsts, and he did not think after the first few days that many of them would be around very long. And Freeman had come to stay. They had calisthenics in the morning and then 6 hours of classes. Exams were scheduled for each Saturday morning. They were not allowed to leave the area, but there was a different movie screened each night in a plush small theater. There was a small PX, a swimming pool, a bar, and a soda fountain. There was a social area at each end of the building in which they lived that included pool tables, ping pong, a television room with color TV, chess and checkers sets. There was a small library containing technical material related to their classes and light fiction, magazines, and periodicals. There was a music room with a stereo console containing an AM/FM receiver with records consisting mostly of show tunes from Broadway hits of the last decade. There were Coke machines. It was like a very plush bachelor officer's quarter. There were basketball courts, badminton courts, a 9-hole golf course, squash courts, a gym, a 220-yard rubberized track, a touch football field. After the intensive screening which they had undergone prior to their selection, none of the rest thought that the classes and examinations were anything more than window dressing. They settled down to enjoy their plush confinement during the training period, after which they would be given offices in the vast building in Langley, Virginia, down by the river. Freeman combined a program of calisthenics, weight training, isometrics, running, and swimming, which never took more than an hour, usually less than half that time. He would watch television or read until dinner, take an hour's nap, and then study until midnight. No one at the training camp, white or colored, thought it strange that Freeman, a product of the Chicago ghetto, where Negroes spend more time, money, and care in the selection of their wardrobe than even in Harlem, should be so badly dressed. Or that although he had attended 2 first-rate educational institutions, he should speak with so limited a vocabulary, so pronounced an accent, and such Uncle Tom humor. They put it down to the fact that he had been an athlete who had skated through college on his fame. Freeman did not worry about the whites because he was being exactly what they wished. The Negroes of the class would be ashamed of him, yet flattered by the contrast. But there might be a shrewd one among them. There was only one. He approached Freeman several times with penetrating questions. The fraternity thing put him off. "You a fraternity man, Freeman?" he asked once over lunch. "Nah, I was once because of the chicks. You had to have that pin, you know. Almost as good as a letter in football. But I thought that kind of stuff was silly. I used to be a Kappa." He looked at Freeman coldly. "I'm still a Kappa," he said. He finished lunch and never spoke to Freeman again. Midway through the fourth week, three of the group were cut. They were called into the front office and informed that their grades were not up to standard, and that same evening they were gone. Panic hit the group, and there were several conferences concerning what should be done. Several long-distance phone calls were made, three to politicians, five to civil rights bureaucrats. The group was informed that they were on their own and that after the time, energy, money, and effort that had gone into their integration, they should feel obligated to perform up to the highest standards. Freeman had received the best grades in each of the exams, but no one was concerned with that fact. Two others left the following weekend, although their grades were among the highest in the group. Freeman guessed correctly that it was for homosexuality and became convinced that in addition to being bugged for sound, the rooms were monitored by closed-circuit TV. He was right. The telephones, even the ones in the booths with coin boxes, were bugged as well. The general received a weekly report regarding the progress of the group. It appeared that those intellectually qualified could be cut on physical grounds. They were already lagging at the increasing demands of the morning calisthenics and were not likely to survive the rigors of hand-to-hand combat. The director of the school confidently predicted that not one of the Negroes would survive the 10 weeks of the school, which would then be completely free for a new group of recruits presently going through preliminary screening. It was to the credit of Freeman's unobtrusive demeanor that the school's director did not even think of him in spite of his excellent grades and physical condition when making his report to the general. If he had, he might have qualified his report somewhat. The general instructed his school's director to forward complete reports to the full senatorial committee. He intended to head off any possible criticism from Senator Hennington. He could not know that the senator was not in the least concerned with the success or failure of the Negro pioneers to integrate the Central Intelligence Agency. He had won his election, and for another 6 years, he was safe. When this group is finished, I want you to begin screening another. Don't bother to select Negroes who are obviously not competent. They have already demonstrated their inability to close the cultural gap, and no one is in a position seriously to challenge our insistence not to lower standards for anyone. It will cost us a bit to flunk out 6 or 8 a year, but we needn't worry about harassment on this race thing again in the future if we do. It's a sound investment, said the general. He was pleased and again convinced that he was not personally prejudiced. Social and scientific facts were social and scientific facts. He ate a pleasant meal in his club that evening and noted that there were both white and colored present. The whites were members and guests. The Negroes served them. The general did not reflect that this was the proper order of things. He seldom approved of the rising of the sun either. Two more were cut for poor marksmanship. Freeman had obtained an ROTC commission at college and had served in Korea during the police action. He was familiar with all of the weapons except the foreign ones, and a weapon is a weapon. Only the extremely high silic rate of the Schmeisser machine pistol bothered him, and that did not last very long. Mr. Freeman, the retired Marine gunnery sergeant said, "That is an automatic weapon and designed to be fired in bursts. Why are you firing it single shot?" "It's to get its rhythm, Sergeant. I couldn't control the length of the bursts at first, and I was wasting ammo, but I think I have it now." The sergeant knew that Freeman had been an infantryman, and Marines, in spite of what they claim, have at least a modicum of respect for any fighting man. "Okay, Mr. Freeman, show me what you mean. Targets 1 through 5 and use only one clip." "Call the burst, Sergeant." 3, 5, 5. He called the number of rounds he wanted in rapid succession, as fast as Freeman could fire them. There were rounds left for the final target, and, on inspection, they found that 1 5-round burst had been 6 instead. "That is very good shooting, Mr. Freeman. Were you a machine gunner in Korea?" "No. I was in a heavy weapons company for a while and got to know MGs fairly well, but I spent most of my time in a line infantry company. I like automatic weapons, though. I learned it's not marksmanship, but firepower that wins in a firefight. I want to know as much as I can about these things." "All right, Mr. Freeman, I'll teach you what I know. You can have all the extra practice and ammo you want. Just let me know a day ahead of time, and I'll set it up. We'll leave the Schmeisser for a while and start with simpler jobs, and then work up. Pistols, too?" "Yes, I'd like that, Sergeant. And I'd rather your maintenance section didn't clean them for me. I'd rather do it myself. No better way I know of to learn a weapon than to break it down, clean, and reassemble it." The gunnery sergeant nodded his head, and something rather like a smile crossed his face. Freeman read everything in the library on gunnery, demolition, subversion, sabotage, and terrorism. He continued to head the class in examination results. There was much more study among the group now, and they eyed one another uneasily, wondering who would be next to go. They had no taste for returning to the jobs they had left. Civil rights bureaucracies, social welfare agencies, selling insurance, heading a playground in the ghetto, teaching school, all of the grinding little jobs open to a non-professional middle-class Negro with a college degree. Long after Freeman retired, between midnight and 1, his program not varying from the schedule he had established during the first week, the rest of the class studied far into the night. The group was given the Army Physical Aptitude Test, consisting of squat jumps, push-ups, pull-ups, sit-ups, and a 300-yard run. Freeman headed the group with a score of 482 out of a possible 500. The men finishing 2nd and 3rd to him in academics were released when they scored less than 300 points. There were only 2 other athletes in the group, one a former star end at Florida A&M, the other a sprinter from Texas Southern. They were far down on the list academically, although they studied each night until dawn. It was just a matter of time before they left. In 2 months, there were 5 of the group left, including Freeman. Hand-to-hand combat rid them of 2 more. The instructor was a Korean named So, but Calhoun, his supervisor, was an American from North Carolina. The niggers would leave, or Calhoun would break their necks. He broke no necks, but he did break one man's leg and dislocated another's shoulder. He was surprised and angered to find that Freeman had studied both judo and jiu-jitsu and had a brown belt in the former and a blue stripe in the latter. He would throw Freeman with all the fury and strength he could muster. Each time, Freeman took the fall expertly. He dismissed the rest of the class one day and asked Freeman to remain. "Freeman, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think your people belong in our outfit. I don't have anything against the rest of the group. I just don't think they belong. But you, I don't like. Well, I guess that's your hang-up. I don't like your goddamn phony humility, and I don't like your style. This is a team for men, not for misplaced cotton pickers. I'm gonna give you a chance. You just walk up to the head office and resign, and that will be it. Otherwise, we fight until you do. And you will not leave this room until I have whipped you and you walk out of here or crawl out of here or are carried out of here and resign. Do I make myself clear? Yes, Whitey, you make yourself clear. But you ain't running me nowhere. You're not man enough for that. Freeman felt the adrenaline begin coursing through his body, and he began to get that limp, drowsy feeling, his mouth turning dry. I can't back away from this one, he thought. Mr. So will referee. International judo rules. No chops, kicks, or hand blows. Falls and chokeholds only. After a fall, you get 3 minutes rest, and we fight again, and I keep throwing you, Freeman, until you walk out of this outfit for good. Mr. So? They bowed formally and circled one another, each reaching gingerly for handholds on the other's jacket. He had 15 pounds on Freeman and wore a black belt, but a black belt signifies only that the wearer has studied judo techniques enough to instruct others. The highest degree for actual combat is the brown belt Freeman wore. Calhoun was not a natural athlete and had learned his technique through relentless and painstaking practice. His balance was not impressive, and he compensated with a wide stance. Freeman figured his edge in speed all but nullified his weight disadvantage. He had studied Calhoun throughout the courses. He had watched him when he demonstrated throws and when he fought exhibition performances with So. Freeman was familiar with his technique and habits and knew that he favored two throws above all others, a hip throw and a shoulder throw, both right-handed. He came immediately to the attack. Freeman avoided him easily, feeling him out, testing his strength. Calhoun was very strong in the shoulders and arms, but as slow as Freeman had anticipated. He compensated by bullying his opponent and keeping him on the defensive. Calhoun tried a foot sweep to Freeman's left calf, a feint, then immediately swung full around for the right-handed hip throw. Freeman moved to his right to avoid the sweep, as the North Carolinian had wanted. Then, when Calhoun swung into position for the hip throw, his back to Freeman, Freeman simply placed his hand on his back, and before he could be pulled off balance and onto the fulcrum of Calhoun's hip, pushed hard with his left hand, breaking contact. It had been a simple and effective defensive move, requiring speed and expert timing. They circled and regained their handholds on each other's jackets. After a few minutes of fighting, realizing that he was outsped, Calhoun began bullying Freeman in an effort to exhaust him. So signaled the end of the first five-minute period. They would take a three-minute rest. By now, Freeman knew his opponent. You'd be dangerous in an alley, thought Freeman, but you hung yourself up with judo. Karate or jiu-jitsu, maybe, to slow me down with the chops and kicks. But there is just no way you can throw me in judo, white boy. He wondered whether to fight or to continue on the defense. He looked at Calhoun, squatting, Japanese style, on the other side of the mat, the hatred and contempt naked on his face. No, he thought, even if I blow my scene, I got to kick this O-Fay's ass. When you grab me again, Whitey, you are going to have two handfuls of 168 pounds of pure black hell. He took slow, deep breaths and waited for the 3 minutes to end. So, nodded to them, they strode to the center of the mat, bowed, and reached for one another. Freeman changed from the standard judo stance with feet parallel, body squared away, and facing the opponent to a variation. Right foot and hand advanced, identical to a southpaw boxing stance. It is an attacker's stance, the entire right side being exposed to attack and counter from the opponent. Freeman relied on speed, aggressiveness, natural reflexes, and defensive ability to protect himself in the less defensive position. He wanted only one thing, to throw this white man. He moved immediately to the attack. Freeman tried a foot sweep, his right foot to Calhoun's left, followed up with a leg throw, astigare, then switched from right to left, turning his back completely to his opponent, whose rhythm he had timed, and threw him savagely with a right-handed hip throw. Calhoun lay there and looked at Freeman in surprise. He got slowly to his feet, rearranging his judo jacket and retying his belt. Freeman did the same, then, facing him, he bowed, as is the tradition. Calhoun remained erect, staring at Freeman coldly. Freeman maintained the position of the bow, hands on thighs, torso lowered from the hips. Calhoun-san, you a judoka, you will return bow of Freeman-san, hissed so. Reluctantly, Calhoun bowed. They returned to their places on the mat, squatting Japanese style, waiting for the 3 minutes to end. Freeman wondered if he could keep from killing this white man. No, he thought, he's not worth it, and it would really blow the scene. But he does have an ass-kicking coming, and he can't handle it. This cat can't believe a nigger can whip him. Well, he'll believe it when I'm through. So signaled them to the center of the mat. Freeman methodically chopped Calhoun down. He threw him with a right foot sweep, a left-handed leg throw, another hip throw, and finally a right-handed shoulder throw. Calhoun, exhausted by now, but refusing to quit, reacted too slowly and landed heavily on his right shoulder, dislocating it. So forced the shoulder back into the socket and the contest was finished. Saying nothing, they bowed formally and Freeman walked slowly to the locker room. It was the end of the day, Friday, and he would have the weekend to recuperate. He would need it. Calhoun asked for an overseas assignment. Within 3 days, he left for leave at his family home in North Carolina, then disappeared into the Middle East. Freeman would have to be more careful. There were holes in his mask. He would have to repair them.
Context of white supremacy. That is the end of chapter 2, so we'll pick up in chapter 3 for the second audio segment. This is our first study session. Sam Greenlee, the spook who sat by the door. Folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-POUND. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to join the discussion, but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free HD line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. The address again, tinyty.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Once you do that, it will open a small window on your screen, the top line. It is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name, you can use a nickname, you can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. Same procedure if you want to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. Once you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt to press the number 1. We will get you on the line. I'll see your hand on the switchboard, and you can join the discussion. The only thing I will say, this, in my opinion, I know we have writers who listen to the Cows, folks who either do essays. I know we even have some folks who do their own bit of fiction writing, novels and such. I generally have a prejudice against fiction. Most of the books that I read are nonfiction. The vast majority of books that we have done on the book study session have been nonfiction, with the exception of, you know, a few here and there, the Turner Diaries, The Bluest Eye. I think there have been 2,000 seasons. I think that might have been it over the 4 years now that we've been doing this. But I think this is just a phenomenal illustration of using fiction to reveal truth about white supremacy, racism. It's entertaining. It's funny. We really haven't even got that far into it, and I think you can see a lot of that already. Just something I think folks should pay attention to. I think there are many ways that you can go about trying to share information, accurate information, understanding about white supremacy. This might be one. We shall see. Folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, who have comments they would like to share, line should be open. Feel free to share your thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. This is one of my favorite books of all time. I read it a number of years ago, so I'm really happy to be reading it again. His movie is also probably in my top three, definitely my top three, but absolutely in my top five. It was my son's favorite movie. Actually, he learned the entire movie. That's how much he watched it. He just thought it was the best movie he had ever seen. And he still pretty much feels that way at 21. And he first saw it when he was probably about 12 or 11. And he also actually interviewed Mr. Sam Greenlee. Rest in peace to him. When he was 13 years old, he had interviewed him. And it was a powerful thing for my son to be able to have that sort of contact with someone of his caliber, especially the person who's at that time, you know, he really was into the movie heavy. So it was a big honor for him to talk to him. And he said a lot of life changing things to my son and helped to also expand his consciousness about how the system of white supremacy works in entertainment. So I just want to give a maximum respect to Sam Greenlee. To get to the text itself is brilliant. Just like you said, on workplace racism, there's a lot of things, I think, a lot of counter-racist information we can garner from this text, just from how he wrote it and the sorts of topics that he approaches and how he broaches them within the confines of the text. On page 4, he writes, he had spent the morning searching for the source of his senator's displeasure until his head ached. The handwriting was on the wall, and Summerfield knew his job was at stake. He must discover the source of displeasure and remove it. Perhaps he should wear ready-made clothes. Had the senator somehow seen him driving the Lincoln rather than the Ford he always drove to the office? It was essential never to have a more impressive car than one's boss. He told his newly integrated Negro friends that anyone discovered the encounter with the white girl in Colorado Springs when he had accompanied the senator on a trip to the Air Force Academy. He had been certain that he had acted with the utmost secrecy and discretion, but he had known even then that it was a stupid move which might threaten his entire career. That one paragraph was very, very powerful. We've talked about this on the job, workplace racism is in regards to driving a better car than your boss or coming into the job looking better than your boss or doing anything to stand out in a way in which that they feel that they might be paying you too much money. So just that understanding, Sam Greenlee has such a deep understanding of the white psyche for him to even place this paragraph in the text. And when he discussed also his clandestine tryst with this white woman, he also understood, thank you, it was nauseating to read, but it's understandable in the text. I think it also gives insight into the white psyche in regards to black males' relationship with white females and the levels that they will stoop to destroy a black male if they know that he's had sexual contact with a white female. Of course, Dr. Wilson Moment, due to their fear of genetic annihilation. On the following page, he wrote something that says, Gil, said the senator's wife, why don't we accuse the Central Intelligence Agency of a discriminatory hiring policy? Segregation in the CIA? Yes. They have Negro officers at all. They have no Negro officers at all, mostly menial and clerical help. Are you certain, Belinda? This could be what we're looking for. I'm positive, but I'll check it out. We have a man in personnel over there, you know. This here just speaks to they are trying to manipulate using race as a means to put forth their version of white supremacy as the one to reign supreme when he gets this position, gets voted into this political position. So this really speaks to what you say all the time, and I mirror that myself. White people are not ignorant about racism. On the following page, he writes, they'll deny it at first, said Belinda, then probably claim their personnel files are classified, but they'll back down when they get enough negative press coverage. They're very image conscious nowadays. Carter Summerfield sat looking interested but carefully silent. Advising the senator how to criticize other whites was definitely not one of his functions. I can program one of these computers to provide statistics showing the increased efficiency of the armed forces since their integration, said Tom. If CIA does select a Negro, he'll be the best known spy since 007, said Harry. And I found that section where Carl Summerfield said that he sat interested but carefully silent. And when he speaks about what thinks in his head, that his job was not advising the senator how to criticize other whites. I found that to be very profound because, you know, we're not supposed to talk. You say it all the time. I agree. We're not supposed to talk about racism on the job or in the presence of whites that we know or understand can damage us in any way as far as our situation at work or just putting us in a position of compromise. And I found that to be profound that he understood where to draw the line in regards to helping his boss, but not helping him to the point where he exposes his understanding of racism and white supremacy by giving him information that he could use against other whites. On page 9, he writes, Senator Hennington said the committee chairman in his rich aristocratic Southern drawl, we all know that deceit, hypocrisy, duplicity are the everyday tools of our agents in the field. Much to their credit, the childlike nature of the colored mentality is ill suited to the craft of intelligence and espionage. And I found that a very telling paragraph because for him to speak about black people as childlike in nature and that our mentality is ill-suited to the craft of intelligence and espionage really brings home the understanding that he understands that black people have been dumbed down to the point of stupidity. Via racism, white supremacy is something that we've talked about quite a bit on this program. Just the fact that this system is designed to make us stupid and make us function in dysfunctional ways, first with one another and then how we interact in society as far as us collectively focusing to end the system of white supremacy. So I just found that to be telling that this white person understood that in the way in which he articulated that in the paragraph. The two paragraphs down, he says, "There is a question of cover," said the general. "An agent must be capable of fading into the background, adopting the guise of the person one cannot remember minutes after meeting him. Negroes in the field would be far too conspicuous." So he's basically saying we're going to be dealing with a lot of situations where they're going to be mostly white people, and to put a black person there knowing that the entire planet functions on the system of racism and white supremacy, that a black person would stand out in the way in which he would be conspicuous in a white setting. And that just kind of reminds me of how white people can go into black functions and not be questioned about their motives or their reasoning or purpose for being there. And at the same time, they can change the entire dynamic in a room of 500 people. You just put one white person and the entire dynamic of that room changes to where those 500 people, or the vast majority of them, will cater to the feelings and the understandings and leanings of the white person in the room, and forget about the fact that they're there to maybe be putting on a black-centered event. So I find that very interesting. I believe lastly, there was a page, on page 11, he writes, "If it hadn't been the CIA, it would have been someone else. We're not likely to run out of institutions to accuse of segregation in our lifetime, darling," is what the wife of the senator said. And that's very powerful, just simply because they understand that this system has been around for a long time. It permeates every one of the 10 areas of people activity, and they understand that it functions in such a holistic way that they, if they chose to do that again, next time he ran for office, they have numerous different organizations they can call out about their racism and try to use that to their advantage to obfuscate the facts and get black people to vote them into office. And I'll give someone else a chance to speak. I did have a couple other things, but I'll definitely wait. Thank you for taking my call.
Grand. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, who have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. As with the previous caller, this is probably one of my favorite books of all time as far as fiction. I live in the Chicagoland area, and I was able to meet Sam Greenlee right before he passed away. So I was able to talk to him, and it was just outstanding. I read his book in college some years ago, and I finally had met him right before he passed away. But in regards to the chapters that, you know, we've read already, and, you know, it's a joy reading this book again. It was interesting. One of the things that kind of stood out, probably more political than anything, the black vote. When they were talking about how the senator wasn't getting, getting enough black voters, and it shows you what, you know, how, you know, what the times were during, during the 60s, how black people weren't just like giving their votes away, you know, like they're doing now, because unfortunately, too many black people nowadays are too loyal to the Democratic Party. And you can tell by this one, you know, because even back then, even though that they were fighting for civil rights, they still had an agenda. Black folks today don't have an agenda right now. They don't know what to ask for. So it's interesting how going back reading this again and following along, how black folks actually kept their votes in their pockets, unless something was done. And what was interesting, the fight between Calhoun and Freeman, and being refereed by the Korean Sioux. Now, Freeman, you know, was a Korean veteran. And so it's interesting, you know, this metaphor lets me know how much white supremacy, you know, manipulates, you know, non-black people to, you know, fighting each other. But it seems like in this silent moment where when Freeman finally defeated Calhoun, where, you know, soon the Korean, you know, had to, you know,
talk to Calhoun about, you know, respect to his opponent. And they, it's like they silently knew that Calhoun was always, you know, the enemy, you know, and it just symbolizes, you know, the, like I said, two different non-white, you know, people, you know, coming together, realizing that, you know, they're not the enemy, that, you know, Calhoun was the enemy. And so, I mean, I can go on for hours, but I'm going to let somebody else comment. So I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Discuss the host and to the other callers and listeners, just want to say thank you for this book. So this is kind of like, I've listened to some of your other book reviews, but not all of them, you know, all the time. But this one I wanted to hear. So I got the book and I'm reading along. And I think the thing that stuck out to me in the first part of the book is how, kind of like the gentleman right before me said, but how easily black people, back then you called them Negroes, can be so manipulated. And also, too, how devious they can be. And when I was reading that part where the woman, where his wife told him, said, she came up with the idea about segregation in the CIA, and to use that as a, you know, as a ruse or, you know, something to, so that you can get Negro votes. And it made me think about this movie I was watching, was it The Long Kiss Goodnight or something like that, and it's Gina Rowland and Sam Jackson. And I remember the second time when I saw the movie, and, you know, it was basically Gina Rowland played a, she had been like an assassin for the government, and she, I guess, got out the program, so they were hunting her down. But also come to find out that the group she was working for was the government. They were trying to start so that white men could get some money that was working part of the thing. And what got me was that they were going to blow up this bridge, and they took this body of this dead man, like he looked like a Muslim, and put him in the car, you know, so that when the bridge would blow up, they would get this car, they got this body moving, so, you know, now you got, ooh, look at the terrorists and all stuff like that. And as I was reading that, I was just thinking, I said, I know this is a fiction book, and I know that movie, too, is, you know, based on, it's fiction or supposed to be fiction. But I was just thinking, I said, just how devious, just how evil they are, but even so that how devious and how easily manipulated we as a people can be, and how easily we can be used for the things that they want to do. And as I was reading that today earlier at work, it really struck me. And, you know, because I had heard about the book, I heard about the movie, but I had never read the book or I haven't seen the movie. And so I was just, there's a part of me that's kind of like, wow, you know, kind of like shocked. But then there's the other part of me that's like, but Kim, you know these people, you know how they can be. And just the gentleman right before me where he said, even like back then with black people, you know, he was having trouble with that black vote. And I know Negro, but, you know. And the gentleman before me said how, like, back then, they were, you know, you see the book, that was something he had did, so they weren't voting, you know, going to vote for him. And like he said, back then, you know, blacks had something, but today, it's like we don't have an agenda. Today, I think we can see black people with Hillary, and it's just, you're just giving, blacks are giving her their vote, not to make a criticism, but, you know, kind of like we did President Obama, and I was one of the ones, too. So I think that's the biggest thing so far in reading the book, is just how, even because I was sitting out there on my break, and I said, man, I said, this book is almost 50 years old, and what I'm reading back, you know, said at that time, cause, you know, the book was copyright 69, I said, here it is almost 50 years later, and I said, you almost see the same things, the manipulation, how we are used to benefit others, you know, to our detriment. So, you know, I just want to thank you. I'm going to keep, you know, I'm going to keep with this one. I'm going to hear this one on out. So I just want to thank you, you know, for this book. And I just wanted to say that I'll mute myself. Thank you.
on, right on. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I found it interesting choice, this book, because of the nature of it and the humor that's involved also. First, you got this senator that is trying to be reelected, and then, of course, they're using the computer to, you know, tally up the votes, see how well he's doing. Now, you know, the facade is all of the makeup that he's putting on and the grin of his temples, the certain type of makeup, his presentation, you know, and he also brought up his voting rights. I mean, his record on voting for civil rights. You know, this is all political, so he's wondering how he stands with the Jewish vote. Oh, you're solid with the Jews. It's the Negro that you have to worry about. And see, now, this brings up a point that even if they, no matter what they say throughout their record in votings or whatever they say in order to get elected or reelected, it's all rhetoric because nothing is being done and there's not going to be any changes. And that was brought out in the fact that when they came up with the idea to charge the CIA with discriminatory practices, then they had to choose a black or a Negro that would be the first. And then they said somewhere in the book that he'll be the best known spy since 007 because, you know, he'd be black. And they said, well, he'll find it a bit difficult after all the publicity he's going to get, said the senator. You mean, Gil, said his wife, the publicity you're going to get. See, it's even come up with the idea of getting the CIA integrated, there's still no concern for the Negroes or the Negro that will be the first CIA agent. It's all a selfish motive on the politician's part. He just want to get elected. He don't care about what happens to the first CIA agent. And then all of the candidates that show up are all representatives of civil rights workers or some type of black leaders. It's our idea of what the white people are looking for us to be so that we can imitate that as best we can so that we can, you know, get somewhere in this society. But then it shows the intelligence of Freeman when he looked past that and into the present. On first, he's got to set himself apart from the rest of the Negroes. And then hopefully he'll be overlooked by the whites until it's too late. That seems like a strategy, a pretty good strategy. And then when he, the fight between him and Calhoun, I think the names of the characters, you know, are significant because the protagonist's name is Freeman, and then your racist instructor from North Carolina is Calhoun. And then Mr. So, who is Korean. Is more advanced in hand-to-hand combat than Calhoun, and actually beats him, and Calhoun transfers. It's like, you know, even if you fail at something, you know, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. So it just makes for an interesting opening, you know, and showing the dynamics of black interaction with whites, and thinking that it would be the black middle class, you know, that would end up being the first in this, because they would be the most flattering to whites because they are imitating them. And I think that it's going to be more intriguing as it goes along. I'm just going to hang in there and see what happens. So thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Yes, sir. Any other folks that we have not heard from? If you all had commentary?
Feel free. Sure.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all. I'm Thomas Smith from New York. Yeah, this book is different from the mold, I guess, this fiction, but I've never read the book before, but I did see the movie. And I didn't see the movie until I met Ross and kind of said, hey, it's on YouTube. You know, you should check it out. And I did, and I was very intrigued. So I'm glad we're reading this book. And I actually went to my grandmother's house and got my uncle's original of this book. So I could read along. So it's pretty good. This is great. I would like to just read out some points. I think that everyone touched on it, but you know, it says you're solid with the Jews, Senator. We're in trouble with the Negroes. The Negroes, explained Senator Hennington. Why, I have the best voting record on civil rights on Capitol Hill. Just last year, I broke the ADA record for correct voting on civil rights at 97.64. Our polls revealed a sharp decline after your speech requested a moratorium on civil rights demonstrations. As we regain most of what we lost, Negro percentile, Senator, we're home free. And just to bring that home with page 4, just a short paragraph, this question of the Negro vote could be serious. I never thought I'd be in trouble with those people. You have to come up with something which will remind them I'm the best friend they have in Washington and soon. And while reading this part, say, you know, this is probably every Democratic meeting today. This is just how I think they look at us, you know, a voting block that they have, and let's vote on certain things to keep them happy. Just bringing it to today's context, you know, and I don't think it pointed out what Pennington was a political affiliation, and this was in the 60s, so I'm not sure if the Democrats really had a stronghold on the black yet, but I could just see this being probably Hillary Clinton right now, you know, Trump posed a strong leaning on the black vote, and she's probably saying that I've been voting good with these niggas all these years, I would get all I've done for them, and what am I going to do to get them back, you know, let's send out Obama. No, that's, I mean, it's very interesting. Another part, and I thought this was hilarious, and this is also very telling of how they think of us. This is page 8. It's not true that we don't have any color at the agency. Our entire kitchen staff, our maintenance section, and drivers are all colored. And I think this is every corporation today. You know, they have to have a certain amount of non-white people working for them, and they put them in a certain position, at least at every company I worked at, the entire low section of the staff is the Negroes, or the colored people, as they called them back then. And I'm very glad we're reading this book. I mean, I have to quote on, but I think everyone kind of touched on the things. This seems like this copy was in 1969. So this was probably one of these books written to counter the integration movement that was going forward at that time, that was being pushed. And I think Mr. Greeley was very smart. I'm sure the end result of that movement was going to be what we have today. And he was with this book against it. That's what I think. And I'll give my line. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Anybody else that we have not heard from have commentary that they wanted to share?
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. Good evening to everyone on the line. When you first started reading, I thought when he said, I think he said he had to know how to kind of, well, to paraphrase, the lay low until it was too late. And I was thinking of the movie The Butler. Like, that was the same thing he said. I guess that was the goal, to be a great butler, to be, I guess, for lack of a better term, visibly invisible. Like, they know you're there, but you're not supposed to do any work. You're not supposed to kind of make your presence known. And it just goes to show that whatever level you are as a black person, that's kind of your role. And I don't think according to the text, the other Negroes, I guess, they didn't get that part. I guess they thought they won't be a superstar and all that, which I'm not knocking anybody who's trying to be a superstar, but when you go into certain roles, that's kind of what you have to do. Even if you think about people now like Gabby Douglas, she just wants to flip and be happy that she got a medal. She can't get to put a hand on her heart or whatever, you know. You can't do anything else but what we expect you to do. That was all. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Other folks, if you have commentary, you should get your hand up now. We have about 20 minutes before we get to the second audio segment. Just context, 1969. So this is like 1 year after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. This is the year that Fred Hampton was assassinated. Vietnam War is rolling. Very turbulent times here in 1969. Also want to make sure that I got in as well. If folks are disgruntled with the narrator, if Gus's reading is damping your enjoyment of the book or ability to comprehend, if anyone else would like to read, that is cool in the gang, because I hate narrating, and I can say that about 50 times. I hate narrating. The only contingency would be, or the only stipulation would be, that you have to read the whole thing. This is a book I'd prefer to just have one narrator do the whole thing. So someone is disgruntled and you're willing to take over and read the whole thing, rock and roll. My feelings would not be hurt at all. This book is not that long. I think we will be done with this book. I can't see this book being more than like five sessions. It's just not super long. All right, that's it. I thought there were a lot of Welsing moments in the book. Dr. Welsing was rolling at this time with some of her work on racism, white supremacy. She, too, being a Chicago native, even from the very beginning when the Senator Hennington is getting all the information about where he stands. And it says the computers have you winning the election, Senator, but by less than 3,000 votes, a small shift, and there goes the ball game. Dr. Welsing said all the time, keep your eyes on the ball. When they continue, when they're talking about the Carter Summerfield, the black person who works with the senator, he's another example of racial showcasing, it seems. We'll just have him there. Looks good. Looks like our staff is integrated. When they're just talking so bluntly, it reminded me of the bell curve, where the whites just all the time are saying that we are so stupid and ignorant, and attributing this to something being genetically defective about us, again, deflecting Dr. Welsing, their melanin deficiency, that it's something about our genes where we just are predisposed to being ignorant, and it's just nothing you can do about that. It's no schooling in the world. John B. Watson, Nobel Prize winner, that was the view that he took. The senator and his wife are talking, and they're saying that
I guess it's not brains we're looking for in him anyway. And his wife smiles. That's his least valuable commodity to us. That is certainly the worldview of non-white people, and definitely the way that whites want to see us and want us to think of ourselves. This contempt that the senator has when he says, I never thought I'd be in trouble with those people. We have to come up with something which will remind them I'm the best friend that they have in Washington. It sounds very similar to the tone that I hear from Hillary Clinton supporters and what have you. Bill Maher has been very flagrant in that sort of thing throughout the whole election season. Like, what are you ungrateful niggers doing out here, Black Lives Matter protesting and, foaming at the mouth, yelling at Bill Clinton? Do you want Trump to get the White House? Hillary Clinton is the best friend that you niggers have. You better get your act together and go out there and vote for her. This the same racist, condescending tone that I've heard from a lot of whites, that we are obligated to vote for whoever the Democratic candidate is or whoever is allegedly the friend of the niggers. The portion where Carter Summerfield, where he says he was amazed to find the senator seemed annoyed when his own comments were returned, only slightly paraphrased. I think a lot of folks can relate to that and have shared about that on workplace racism. Think Roz, great points about the car, can't have a better vehicle. The white girl, reminded me of Nate Parker. The whole bit that the Senator Hennington and accusing the CIA of being racist, it reminds me, Mr. Fuller, he has made a point over the years about having correct intentions when you go about doing things. And I submit that racists, reminding me of Nate Parker, they a lot of times will do things with not having the correct intentions, and frequently it will be, most of the time it will be, there is an underlying unseen white supremacist agenda. Even sometimes when they are talking about racism, in this case accusing a white person of being racist, I'm reminded of some of the well-meaning whites, Timothy Wise and some of these other folks that will come out and jump up and down and protest and picket, and Trump is a racist, David Duke is a racist, Donald Sterling is a racist, Paula Sterling is a racist. They'll pick some white person to throw under the bus so that they are not suspected of being racist, so that non-white people will trust them even though they have a different racist agenda. That they have that might not just be seen or what have you, but not having correct intentions. I think whites do a lot of things, even where it's seeming that they're calling out some sort of incorrect or unjust act, treatment, but they still have an underlying agenda that is not correct. Dr. Welzig moment, when they get this closed hearing with the CIA general and Senator Hennington, when he says, Senator Hennington, the other committee members looked at Senator Hennington with shock. They knew he faced a close election in the fall, but this gambit was below the belt when he calls him out in the session. And that Dr. Welzing, she says that sort of always this focus on the genital level, that getting back to white genetic annihilation, that is what all of this is about. That is what is motivating individuals classified as white to practice racism, white supremacy. And again, that white people are not ignorant about racism. They understand this whole little game that's being played. He has a close election. He wants to get the niggers to support him, so he'll accuse someone of being racist, seeming like they're not ignorant about this either, that they understand what this is and kind of have some disdain, some contempt, because you're not supposed to call out other white people as being racist. Next, chapter two. I thought the whole scene with the fight, again, it reminded me of Dr. Welzing, where she has talked about it, I think even has written about. She thinks it is important for black people because we have been groomed to fear whites. It is important for us to think about challenging them, opposing them, literally and physically, metaphorically, challenging, opposing, confronting racist man, racist woman, racist child. And I have that so early in the book where you have an actual physical confrontation between Freeman and Calhoun. I thought that was a just brilliant point that Mr. Demery Ford made about the names. Freeman, it even reminds me of the Boondocks. The main character in this book is Dan Freeman, the main character in the or at least granddad in the Boondocks being Robert Freeman. I don't know, to have to ask Aaron Magruder, but I think it could be
some relationship there. And particularly, I think a lot of times in the Boondocks, his last name is pronounced Free Man. I think about that every time I see his name in this book, since this whole book is about black liberation from white supremacy. But just that the whole physical contest, and in particular, Freeman being so codified, it not being, again, the era of the 60s when this book came out, it not being something that is unplanned. And even I heard Sam Greenlee in one of the interviews saying that is what he wanted to write, that we are in a system of racism, but you don't just have black people resisting and resorting to counter violence in resisting racism, white supremacy, but having a well-conceived, thought-out, organized, systemic plan for countering racism, even if it's going to be counter-violence, that is going to be codified, well thought out in advance, in how I do things. And the name-calling, I thought that was such a brilliant display of codification in that scene where Calhoun is calling him all these names, and you don't belong here, and this is not for cotton pickers, and all this other stuff. And he's upset. He wants to beat him. But even then, I'm going to be codified. I'm going to dissect how I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to go out and execute my plan. I'm not going to be emotional and in a rage about this. I'm codified in how I do business, even if that is the business of counter violence. Just really, really important. And again, reminded me of Dr. Welsing. I contrast this when I hear something like Django Unchained or people saying that's why we need a film like that, because there have not been illustrations of counter violence and black people standing up to whites and killing whites. Great one right here in Mr. Greenlee's book. Anything else I want to make sure? Get in. Oh, man, the whole scene with the black people, this will be my last point. The whole scene where he's distancing himself from the other black people that have been recruited to be members of the CIA, and he's not into all of the high-fiving and talking about, you know, different HBCUs and parties they've been to and sexual activity and all of that, and name-dropping all the conspicuous consumption that is mentioned. He's not into all of that. He's just, you know, on his codified mission, what he's there to accomplish. I thought that was a great rebuke of the brothers and sisters. I am really Mr. Fuller's concept of united independent, that I am not looking at them as my comrades, my homies, my brothers, my partners, none of that. I don't even expect any sort of, you know, fraternity with them. I don't expect any help from them, if not outright disdain and contempt, and that's fine too. I am on my mission, what I am here to accomplish. Just really important aspect of codification. And again, to get that early in the book, kind of dispelling this notion that just because we are black, we're on the same team and you're going to be helping me out. That seems to be challenged right at the onset of the book. I will hush there. Other folks have comments, things that stood out? I think we got everybody who shared. So if you have second comments or something else stood out, feel free. We have about 8 minutes before we get to the second audio segment.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you so much. I had a couple of things, and I'll hush my mouth. The next thing was on page 12. Mr. Greenlee writes, Freeman watched the class reunion from a corner of the common room of the CIA training barracks. It was a black middle-class reunion. They were black bourgeoisie to a man. To a man, black nepotism personified. Black nepotism personified. In addition to those who had recruited themselves upon receiving notice that the CIA was now interested in at least token integration, five were relatives or in-laws of civil rights leaders, four others of Negro politicians. Only Freeman was not middle class, and the others knew it. Even had he not dressed as he did, not used the speech patterns and mannerisms of the Chicago ghetto slums, they would have known. His presence made them uneasy and insecure. They were members of the black elite, and the product of the ghetto streets did not belong among them. And I just found that to be interesting, because it really points a nice, or brings out a nice understanding of how when black people were allowed to get an education, that education was basically to breed dissension amongst ourselves. And that sort of mistreatment that he was getting from other black people who had maybe a better financial background than him and were groomed and cultivated to think that Northern blacks were better and had more class and were more advanced than blacks from the South. I found that to be a great standout paragraph that kind of speaks to that sort of thing. And also you can see that even just from experience, just looking at Minister Malcolm, you know, just because you might come from that environment doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot become a person of note in regards to fighting racism, white supremacy, and making a way and actually, in a lot of ways, excelling towards what you put your mind to in a way that those who are compromised by the system of white supremacy end up not doing. The next thing was on the following page, they write, play, who do you know and who do you have, who you have screwed? Blow your blues, your nigger soul sold for a mess of materialistic pottage. You can't ever catch Charlie, but you can ape him and keep the gap widening between you and those other niggers. You have a ceiling on you and yours, your ambitions, but the others are in this basement and you will help Mr. Charlie keep them there. If they get out and above your level, then what will you have? They eye him in uneasily. He was an alien in this crowd. Somehow he had escaped the basement. He had moved up to their level and he was a threat. He must be put in his place. He would not last. Reading told, but he should know that he was among his betters. And I think we talked about this recently on the workplace racism in regards to how we view and mistreat each other because we might feel that we're in a supervisory position, so we're getting a little bit more off of masses' table. And as a result, we have to hold back other black people from either attaining our position or out-excelling us if we feel in some form or fashion that they might be better qualified or actually just better for the position than we are. And this is just really, I think, just really deals with the mentality of anti-blackness and how it can manifest in such an acute way. And it's, again, just something we need to work against. And the final thing I wanted to talk about was on the following page. He wrote, had he not made a mistake, he thought, all niggas looked alike to whites, and he had thought it to his advantage to set himself apart from this group in a way that would make the whites overlook him until it was too late. They would automatically assume that the others who looked and acted so much like their black representatives and spokesmen who appeared on the television panels, spoke in the halls of Congress, made the covers of Time and Life, and ran the Negro newspapers and the magazines who formed the only link with the white world, would threaten to survive this test. Both the whites and these sadiddy niggers, Freeman thought, would ignore him until too late. And he thought whitey will be more likely to ignore a nigger who approaches the stereotype than these others who think imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I found that to be just brilliant codification. It's something that I apply on every job that I go to as far as just the way that I function. I never expose, you know, who I am or what I think. I do, after vetting people, I might make counter-racist contact with people outside of the job. So I function in a very codified manner, very similar to that. And it's something that I think we can really get from reading this book, and that can help people in workplace situations that are dealing with racism on how to function once you get there, especially if you're starting a new position rather than a job that you've already been functioning at in an uncodified manner, and then you change your behavior. So I just thought that that was something that we can learn from, both from watching the movie and from reading the book. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Just wanted to read a person's comment they wrote in really quick. They said, Hillary Clinton did the same thing as the senator did when she used mothers of the murdered black men, black people, on her campaign to appeal to black voters. Freeman uses a lot of restraint and little to no emotion when navigating through his training. It proves to be very effective when he beats Calhoun. Caller in Ohio.
Wow. That quote, I mean, that you just read is something else. And that's what I wanted to say, too. It was the wife who come up with that ideal about the CIA. And keep in mind, this book, I mean, you know, for me, I have to say it's copyright 1969. And remember, at that time, it was supposed to be white women, what, coming into black women, feminists, oh, we got to do this. And just to see how devious they are. I do realize this is a fiction, you know, it's a fiction book, But still, it just goes to show you. And then even for the, what you just read, where somebody sent in and basically says, yeah, you know, Hillary Clinton did the same thing. And it just goes to show you. And I'll just say this and I'll read my line. I remember one time I was looking at a video by Dr. Laila Africa, and he mentioned about, he said, white women, he said, really, they are the ones that's running the show, you know, in the white community. And I was telling a friend of mine, like, we were talking about political wise, and keep in mind, this is a politician, his wife. And I said, beware of the political wife. I said, a lot of times, not to take nothing from these white men, I said, but a lot of times you see these white men, I hear politicians, you know, run for office. A lot of times it's that white woman behind the scenes that is calling all the shots. No matter how devious or evil they are, she's the one that's doing it. And I just wanted to say that, and I'll read my line. Thank you.
Right on. Anybody got anything that they can get in 30 seconds before we get to the second audio clip?
Yes, I just thought that I would mention that the book refers to you know, sexual deviance, and it'll be interesting how he uses that, because when you're talking about, you know, whites' idea of black people or so-called Negroes, then you have to make it a hypersexual type thing. So it's interesting how he's weaving that in. I'll mute my line.
Right on. As we get to the second audio clip, for people who have seen the book, if you would like to point out points of deviation, I remember I read the book first and then I saw the movie. It's been a while since I've read the book. I've seen the film many more times since I read the book last. My impression after seeing the movie the first time was that I thought the book was better. There are deviations between the two, even though Sam Greenlee worked on it. I'll try and pick those out. Others can as well. I think the first audio segment that we heard is the film is pretty true to the first two chapters of the book. There are a few differences, but I mean, for the most part, it's pretty much in line. I don't think Carter Summerfield is in the movie. I guess that would be a pretty big difference. There is about to be a pretty big omission, something that's in the book that is not in the film, that is pretty significant in my opinion, but keep that in mind. We also will have a reference to the book that we just finished, Blood Brothers. You can kind of be alert to that as we go along. But we're on chapter 3. I think I said this before, if you do not have the book and you would like the book, I might be able to assist with that if you want to follow along. Again, this book should be available in your library or what have you. Should even be a book that you have in your library, to be truthful. So without further ado, we will get started. This is Chapter 3, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, written by Sam Greenlee, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2. Chapter 3. The director of the school reported to the general on the new group. General, I'm afraid there is at least one who might stick it. I thought you had told me only 2 weeks ago there was hardly a chance that any of that group would last. That's correct, General. Even with the facts on paper before me as I made the report, I somehow forgot that the man existed. He has a way of fading into the background. You can't remember his face or what he looks like or what he has said even minutes after you have spoken to him. But the records speak for themselves. He leads the class in everything, and his marks are above average, although not by much, for our regular classes. Who is the man? His name is Freeman, sir. Is that the one who had the altercation with Calhoun? Yes, sir, and so reports that he could have killed Calhoun. So thinks him one of the finest natural judoists of his experience. But Calhoun is rated one of the best men we have in hand-to-hand combat. That's true, General, but in all honesty to Calhoun, this man has had several years' experience as a judoist. He has fought in the Midwest Regional Championships for the last 3 years, qualifying for the national finals, but refusing the trip because of work commitments. Our physical instructor considers him
one of the finest natural athletes he has ever seen. True, they do make good athletes. Great animal grace and reflexes. I'm disappointed, however, in Calhoun. He should never have lost his head, challenged the man. So indicates that there was no provocation. He's just too dedicated to the agency. Can't stand the idea of standards being lowered. Can't say that I disagree with him. Well, he has a chance to prove himself in Yemen. The general picked up some papers from his desk in dismissal. When the director of the school had almost reached the door, the general lifted his head. This man Freeman, if he survives this group, is to go into the incoming class. He might do well among his own people, but competing with whites might be another cup of tea. He is not to be treated unfairly, but he is not to be given any advantage either. The general motioned the director back to the chair. What kind of man would you say he is? Well, slow-witted, a plotter. He studies 5 hours a day, 7 days a week. Only in athletics does he seem to do things naturally. Physically, he could be expected to react instantly and efficiently, but in a mental crisis, I don't know. I thought as much. Then there is no question of his going into the field. Even if he does survive the group, we cannot subject the lives of other agents in the field to his deficiencies. We will find something for him here in headquarters. Thank you. That will be all. Keep me posted on this group. 2 weeks before the scheduled ending of the training, Freeman was alone. He watched the last of the group leave. No one bothered to say goodbye. Freeman had no friends among them, and his continued presence in the camp was an insult. He settled himself in front of the television set and pressed the remote control button and watched the white fantasy world in full color. Freeman finished the course and was congratulated in a small ceremony in the director's office. There were to be 3 weeks before the new group arrived, and he elected to remain in the camp, except for a few days' leave. He drove to an all-Negro housing development just across the Anacostia River and applied for a one-bedroom apartment. He then drove to New York and checked into the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. He made the rounds of the Harlem bars the first evening before heading downtown to the jazz joints. His Robert Hall suit and two pointy shoes were in the hotel closet, his gold-edged tooth cap in a plastic container in the bathroom, a plain one replacing it. He wore black-rimmed glasses of plain glass, Cordovan bluchers, a button-down shirt of English Oxford, and a dark sharkskin suit from J. Press. He saw Thelonious Monk at the Five Spot, the band with Johnny Griffin, Charlie Mingus at the Village Gate. He saw Threepenny Opera in the Village and Five Finger Exercise, The Night of the Iguana, and I Can Get It For You Wholesale on Broadway. He visited the newly opened Guggenheim and decided that Wright had goofed, but he enjoyed the Kandinskys. He visited the galleries on 57th Street and the Museum of Modern Art. His second night, he found a 6-foot compatible whore who knew the night clerk at his hotel. He tipped the night clerk and the bellboy on duty, and each night after that, he would meet her in the bar between 2 and 3, and they would spend the night in his hotel room. He purchased 16 books, but deferred delivery until further notice. The CIA Freeman would not have read these books. Freeman left his suit, shoes, shirt, tie, and tooth cap in a bag with instructions that they be delivered to the storage company that stored the rest of his clothing, records, books, and paintings that had no business in his new existence. He would establish a New York base later. he had pondered the danger of leading a double life and decided that the strain of squaredom would have to be eased somehow from time to time. The few days in New York, doing the simple things he had done, had convinced him more than ever that this was important. He might be the CIA Tom in Washington, but for a few days elsewhere, he would have to become Freeman again. He did not think that even if he ran into his CIA colleagues in New York, identification would be a danger. Niggers all look alike to whites, anyway, and no one would connect the New York Freeman with the Freeman who would pioneer integration in one of the most powerful governmental institutions in the United States. He left early Sunday morning, the top of the car down. He put the Morgan onto the New Jersey Turnpike and headed south for the nation's capital. The Morgan would have to go, he decided. It did not fit his painstakingly created image. He was sorry about that as he listened to the exhaust note over the roar of the wind and the car radio, but a Ford or Chevrolet would be better, perhaps even an Oldsmobile or a Buick. He would be expected to own a car a bit outside his means, a bit more expensive and flashy than those of his peers at the agency. It was not difficult to conform to the image whites desired, since they did most of the work. They saw in most Negroes exactly what they most wanted to see. One need only impressionistically support the stereotype. Whites were fools, and one had constantly to fight in order not to underestimate their power and danger, because a powerful and dangerous fool is not to be underestimated. Add the elements of hypocrisy and fear, and one had an extremely volatile combination. It was a combination that could easily blow the country, even the world, apart. In the Army, Freeman had learned to respect, but not fear, the potential danger of explosives. Rather, he had learned how to use them. He did not, as did the African diplomats, have difficulty with lunch on Highway 1 because he did not bother to try to get a meal in the greasy spoons and truck spots that dotted the highway like cancerous growths of chrome and neon. He stopped along the highway and ate a lunch he had packed the night before from a delicatessen. A pre-mixed martini over the rocks from a thermos, a cold chicken with potato salad, a mixed salad with oil and vinegar dressing, and a small bottle of Chablis, which had chilled in the cracked ice of the cooler. Finished, he discarded the ice, repacked the container, and lay back on the army blanket he had spread under a tree and slept for an hour. He reached Washington just ahead of the incoming weekend traffic and was in camp in time to shower and catch Ed Sullivan on television after a light dinner in the camp dining room. An agent, as Freeman had anticipated, had checked his movements in New York, checking routinely at the hotel and questioning the whore with whom Freeman had slept. They would not find much, since Freeman knew that the people with whom he had talked would have seen nothing out of the ordinary in either his dress or behavior. Besides, Harlem Negroes, particularly hotel employees and prostitutes, seldom tell white men very much, especially those who look and act like cops, regardless of what they claim to be. Free of classes, Freeman increased his personal study and was able to spend time each day working with So on the mat. He added karate to his repartee of judo and jiu-jitsu, and spent time as well on the range firing pistols, rifles, and shotguns, as well as his more favored automatic weapons. Freeman spent each weekend in Washington and became convinced that it was one of the squarest towns in the world. within walking distance of the immaculate white neoclassical center lies some of the worst ghetto slums in the United States. The bigots on Capitol Hill need look no further than a few hundred yards to convince themselves of the inherent inferiority of Negroes and controlling the Capitol like a colonial fiefdom. They can ensure that things will not change racially. He found a whore on U Street and would spend time with her each weekend in a bed in a hotel in the ghetto. She was questioned as well. "Look, honey, what kind of cop you say you were?" "I'm not a police officer." "You look like a cop to me, baby. How come you asking me stuff about this cat? He in trouble?" "He a nice John. What make you think I'm going to tell you anything?" "I'm not a policeman, but I do have police friends." "Like that, huh? I wondered when you start leaning on me. You old fays never no different, no matter how you look. And you college cats with smiles and pink baby faces the worst. Okay, what you want to know?" He slipped her a 20. She picked it up from the table, never taking her eyes off his face. "Have you ever known him to take dope, marijuana, heroin?" "Nah, you don't even smoke much. After he eats, after we done turned a trick, maybe 3 or 4 cigarettes all the time we together. He ain't no junkie, baby." "Does he have a tendency to boast, brag?" "Him? Nah, he don't talk about himself at all. I thought he was a baseball player, even football, although he a little bit small for that. But he could be. He ain't nothing but muscle and prick. If he got any fat on him, I ain't found it." "Does he gamble?" "Nah. One night I took him up to a place. Cat owed me some bread, and I had to collect. Little poker, little craps. He just watch, and when we through, we leave. Tell you something about that man, though. People don't give him no shit. He move quiet, don't say nothing. But I seen some bad cats move around him. This cat owed me the bread. He don't want to pay it. I don't tell him nothing about, what you say his name? Freeman. I don't say nothing about him being my man. I just took him there before we make it to the hotel, and maybe he wants some action. I get a cut. The cat owed me start to get a little off the wall about the bread. Then he look at Freeman. He just standing there watching the crap game. Quiet. Ain't bothering nobody. But this cat owes me the bread. Look at him. And then he look at me. And baby, he give me the bread. And that cat one of the baddest men in D.C. He make 2 of Freeman. But he don't want no part of him. He ain't my man and it wasn't his scene. But I thought about it. And if I had trouble that night, he be in it. And he ain't romantic about chicks on the block. Never comes on like a social worker. How a nice girl like you get to be in this shit? Let me take you out of it, baby. None of that shit. I'm a whore and he knows it, but he treats me like a queen. I think he put me on for a long time, and then I get to like it. He can put me on as long as he wants. I dig the way he treats me. I'm a whore. He knows it. I know it. But when I'm with him, he makes me feel like a queen. What about his sexual habits? Anything, well, unusual? She looked at him through narrowed eyes. So that's your scene. Well, baby, 20 bills ain't enough for no freaks. Come again. Little more bread, dig? I know some chicks don't deal in nothing but freakish tricks, but that ain't my scene. And don't start no shit about the man. I ain't on junk and I can always get my hat and make it to Baltimore, dig? He gave her another 20, blushed furiously, and damned the woman for sensing what no one else knew, that he enjoyed this part of his job, to his shame. Nothing fancy, little straight up and down mostly. Blowjobs ain't his scene. He don't mind a little head now and then, but before the deal goes down, he wants to make it straight.
No way-out positions or jazz, whips and wet towels, no gimmicks. He just likes to screw, baby. Now, don't be disappointed. Now, I could tell you about some real freaks. I got a trick. White boy like you, come down here once a week just to listen. Get his cookies every time. You want to hear some scenes, honey? Or maybe you want me to get a show together? Straight, gay, or both? Anything you want, baby. They were sitting in the back booth of a long, narrow, and very dark bar on U Street. She stroked his thigh and confirmed his excitement. This was the easiest trick she had in a week. She wondered how much she could milk him for. Would you say he might have homosexual tendencies? She threw her pretty black head back and laughed. Him? Man, you wasting your time there. He wouldn't make that scene for nothing. If you got a thing for him, look someplace else. Shit, I ought to know what I'm talking about. I make it that way myself, and it takes one to know one. Anybody could turn me straight. It could be him. I mean, he don't need no fake scenes, and he just want a good professional job. But sometimes he really turns me on, and I ain't had no thing for a man in years. Nah, baby, he ain't gay. But if that's your scene, I know somebody you might dig. She continued to stroke his thigh. Or, baby, I could do things for you. She leaned over, whispering in his ear, and told him in detail what she could do. He backed into the corner of the booth, but continued to listen. Suddenly, he gripped her thigh with one hand and groaned. She moved away, looked at him in contempt, and then she lit a cigarette. He lay back against the corner of the booth until the color returned to his face, a thin film of perspiration on it. She crossed her legs and moved her foot in time to Sonny Stitt on the jukebox. She liked this joint. They had good sounds here. He sat up and wiped his face with a handkerchief, looking around nervously. No one was paying the slightest attention to the booth. She motioned toward the back of the bar. The John back there. He started to slide across the bench of the booth. You forgetting something, honey? She held out her hand. He reached quickly into his pocket and stuffed crumpled bills into her hand. She looked at them, nodded, and moved from the booth to let him pass. She smoothed her red dress, thinking that his grip on her thigh might leave a bruise. She walked to the bar and ordered a drink, fixed her hair in the mirror, and straightened her red dress on her shoulders. She had never worn red before. She had been told all her life that she could not because she was too black. But Freeman had told her that she should wear it because she was a Dahomey queen. She had gone to the library to find out what he had meant because he wouldn't explain and asked for the book he had written down for her. She had found that he was talking about Africa and at first had been angry. But there was the picture of a woman in the book that had looked enough like herself to startle her. Hair kinky and short-cropped with big earrings in her ears. She had taken the book out of the library and painfully read it in its entirety. Then she bought a red dress and later several others when she found the tricks liked it, but mostly because Freeman liked her in red and said so. She wore big, round, and oval earrings like the queen in the picture, but she could not bring herself to wear her hair short and kinky. But sometimes she would look at the picture and see herself there, and for the first time in her life, she began to think that she might be beautiful, as he said. She returned to the booth and sipped her new drink. The trick returned from the John, all police-like and white man strong. He thanked her for her information and cautioned her not to say anything to Freeman. He could not look her in the eye. She blew smoke into his face, and he left. She would need no more tricks that night, and she had done better than for a full weekend with the Patty Boy. She walked to the phone booth and called her chick. "Honey, got a scene working. I won't be able to make it tonight. Big Bread. See you tomorrow, huh? Of course. I miss you. Be cool, baby. Mama will make it up tomorrow. Bye now." She walked out into U Street and took a cab to a small efficiency apartment that she kept for herself. Even her woman did not know of its existence, and she used it when she wanted to be alone. She wanted to be alone tonight and to think about Freeman. She might invite him to her apartment the coming weekend instead of making their usual hotel routine. Men were not her scene, and she knew, but she liked that man. She knew soon after she entered the apartment that she would invite him there.
Chapter 4. Each morning, Freeman would drive his second-hand Corvair to the big building, descend 3 levels, unlock the door of his office, and begin work. He ate in the cafeteria just often enough not to appear aloof. The rest of the time, he would bring his own lunch in his briefcase and eat in his windowless room, listening to rhythm and blues or jazz from the Negro radio station in Washington on a transistor radio. He was the top secret reproduction section chief, and being the only man in the section, he was little more than the highest paid reproduction clerk in Washington. Nevertheless, he was the only Negro officer in the CIA. He was promoted after a year in his cubbyhole. He had been making a run of 200 of a 3-page report dealing with the methods of bribery of Central American union leaders when there was a knock on the door. He stopped the ditto machine, wiped his ink-stained hands on a piece of waste, and opened the door to the general's secretary, Doris, a tall, golden girl from California with big breasts she considered a gift from the gods. "Dan, the general needs someone to give a senator a guided tour of the building. Do you think you can handle it? I usually do it, or one of the other secretaries, but we're up to our ears getting ready for the closed budget hearings next week. Now, if you don't think you can do it, say so, and I'll try to get someone else." "I think I can handle it." "Good. Then we can get right up to the general's office." She was standing very close to Freeman, and when she turned, she allowed one of her jutting breasts to brush his arm. She sat on the edge of his desk while he washed his hands in a basin in the corner. "Don't you like me?" "Why do you ask that?" he said. "Well, you don't seem very friendly when you bring top-secret documents up to the office. Sometimes you don't even seem to know that I'm around." She pouted prettily. "Well," said Freeman carefully, "it's just that I have a great deal on my mind. The responsibility of running the entire top-secret reproduction, you know. I want to make good, and sometimes I'm preoccupied with my duties. You know how it is. Actually, I think you're very intelligent and attractive. Everyone says so. To be the general's executive secretary at your age is quite an accomplishment. All the other brass have secretaries who are much older. I'll try not to be so preoccupied the next time I bring some things to your office." He put on his coat and held the door open for her, and she brushed him again as she passed. He turned out the light and checked the door carefully to see that it was locked. They walked to the elevator, and he pressed the button to summon it. "You're very ambitious, aren't you?" she said. "Yes, I want to be the best reproduction section chief
they've ever had here. Oh, but you are. Everyone says what a good job you're doing, much better than anyone ever expected. You know, I'm ambitious too. I don't want to be a secretary all my life. I've applied for lateral entry into the officers' corps, and if I pass the oral exams next year, I'll get an overseas assignment. I'm sure you'll pass. The elevator arrived and they entered it. He pressed the button for the top floor of the building. Well, I hope so, she said. I'll probably start out under embassy cover, you know, handling cryptography and administration, but I hope eventually to be an operative agent. Well, I'm certain you'll be the prettiest spy whatever they assign you. They left the elevator, Doris managing to brush him again, and walked to the double doors of the general's suite of offices. They entered, and Doris settled herself behind her desk in the outer office and waved to the door behind. Go right in, Dan. The general's expecting you. She thrust her breasts against the powder blue cashmere sweater she was wearing and was smiling to herself when Freeman walked to the door of the general's office. He knocked on the door and entered. The general waved him to a chair next to his massive desk. Sit down, Freeman. Been hearing good things about you. Like being with our team? Yes, sir. Good. I think you know the building and the agency pretty well. Think you could take a group on a guided tour? As you know, we don't give many tours around here and are not staffed up like some of the other publicity hound agencies. It's the Senate committee, or most of them, and we try to keep them happy if we can. Think you're up to it? Yes, sir. Good. Report to Morgan. It was a group of three senators and three congressmen. The senator to whom Freeman owed his job was among them. Senator Hennington was pleasantly surprised to find Freeman his guide. He knew that the rest of the group had flunked out, but as long as there was one Negro, the CIA was integrated. The senator considered it another victory in his long battle in the field of civil rights. He was pleased to be faced with the fruit of his efforts. This, gentlemen, is our communications center, the nerve center of the agency. It operates around the clock, receiving and sending messages from and to the far reaches of the earth. If the communications for one day were laid end to end, they would reach to Denver and back again to Washington. The center, of course, operates around the clock and is fully protected down here from anything except a pinpoint direct hit of an H-bomb of at least 100 megatons. The entire city of Washington could be destroyed, and our communications center would continue to operate, carrying out its vital task as watchdog of the communist conspiracy. In the next room is our computer system, capable of turning the raw material of intelligence coming in through the communications center into viable facts. The kind of facts that keep us at least one step ahead of the Reds. That one crucial step ahead, gentlemen, has probably meant peace until now for the free world. Lose it by even half, and we may well lose our freedom with it. Freeman showed them through the building, climaxing the tour with a demonstration in the indoor firing range, himself firing alongside the regular firing master. That was certainly fine shooting, Freeman. Had you done a great deal of shooting before you came into the agency? No, sir, but the agency demands that we all qualify at least as marksmen and a very high percentage check out as experts. That's very interesting. Tell me, where did you go to school? Howard? Fisk? No, sir. Michigan State and the University of Chicago. Really? They have some fine football teams at Michigan State. I'll never forget their Rose Bowl victory a few years back. Tremendous comeback in the last quarter. Were you out there for that one? Yes, sir. Senator, Freeman played on that Rose Bowl team, said Morgan. Is that right? You know, I played football for Dartmouth a few years back. He turned to Morgan, CIA Congressional Liaison Officer, and asked, Mr. Morgan, do you suppose Mr. Freeman could join us for lunch? Of course, Senator. They completed the tour and had lunch in the executive dining room, the senator insisting that Freeman sit next to him. The senator was deft in handling Negroes. As he often told members of his own staff, it was important to make them feel comfortable, to treat them as equals. This was very difficult for the senator, since he really did not feel that there were very many people equal to himself, white or black. The senator had a polished, practiced humility that wore well, however. His wit, charm, and good looks more often than not left people feeling that he was a regular guy. And although the senator did not feel himself a regular guy, he would have been pleased at the accolade, since Americans regularly elected regular guys to office. Tell me, Mr. Freeman, do you like working for the agency? The senator had found that calling Negroes Mr. often had a magical effect on the relationship. Oh, yes, sir. I think it's an extremely important job, and I'm proud to be a small part of the team. What were you doing before you joined the agency? I was in social work in Chicago. I worked with street gangs in the slums. That's very interesting, Mr. Freeman. Did you enjoy the work? Yes, sir. Freeman used sir with whites as often as possible. He found that it had a magical effect on the relationship. Well, I think that kind of work is important. As I said in a speech on the Senate floor last year, in our hearings on juvenile delinquency, it is extremely important that we establish some human and sympathetic contact with juvenile delinquents, school dropouts, and other youthful members of the culturally deprived. I couldn't agree more, Senator. Yes, I favor a national study on the problem of juvenile delinquency and crime, particularly among the culturally deprived. Excellent idea, Senator. We certainly need another study on that problem. Then, of course, an increase in the construction of low-cost public housing, a training program for high school dropouts, and the introduction of scientific methods of rehabilitation in our reform schools. I'll send you a copy of the speech, Mr. Freeman. Unfortunately, the program was not adopted, but I have high hopes of some federal action in this area in the not-too-distant future. I was discussing this very thing with the president at luncheon just a couple of weeks ago. Yes, sir. Did you find an increase of dope addiction among juveniles during your work with them? Yes, Senator, I did. Yes, that is a major problem. We must strengthen our laws in that area, make the penalties stiffer, but I definitely favor regarding the addict as a sick person rather than a criminal. I couldn't agree more, sir. And of course, there is the problem of increased illegitimate pregnancies among the youth of the culturally deprived. I certainly don't take the extreme stand of those who advocate sterilization, but advice concerning birth control devices should certainly be made available. And in some cases, they should be provided. dependent on the individual case, of course, and tightly controlled. Definitely, Senator. There's a great deal of work to be done in this area. We have to roll up our sleeves and get to work. I told the president last week, and he agreed emphatically. I expect great progress in this area within the next few years. The luncheon ended, and the congressional party spent a few minutes in the office of the director. The senator lingered when the party began to leave for Capitol Hill. General, I was extremely impressed with Freeman. An excellent choice, I think. I had an interesting and enlightening conversation with him concerning his former field, juvenile delinquency. He gave me some excellent tips, things I might be able to use eventually in a Senate speech or perhaps in an article for the New Republic. I think that taking him on as your assistant was an extremely wise move. It's fine to see integration in action. Freeman was appointed the next week as special assistant to the director. He was given a glass enclosed office in the director's suite. His job was to be black and conspicuous as the integrated Negro of the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America. As long as he was there, one of an officer corps of thousands, no one could accuse the CIA of not being integrated. Freeman couldn't have been in a better position for what he intended to accomplish. He had access to most of the general's briefings, attended many of his meetings. He traveled with the general increasingly, and his face became familiar throughout the agency. He took target practice 3 times a week, practiced judo, jiu-jitsu, and karate, and had 1 weekly session of boxing with a retired former middleweight contender. His routine seldom varied, and the periodic checks by the security section confirmed this. He continued his trips to New York. He would check into the Hotel Teresa in Harlem, then leave for his apartment, shaking any possible tail. A shower, a shave, a beef eater's martini, and Freeman, the Tom, became Freeman, the hipster. No one ever blew Freeman's cover. They accepted at face value what he appeared to be because he became what they wanted him to be. Working for the agency, in the agency, Freeman was the best undercover man the CIA had.
And that will do it for this week's section. We'll pick up next week. We'll be on Chapter 5, Spook Who Sat by the Door. This is the Cals. If you would like to chime in, the number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We have about a half hour left, so please do not wait till the last minute. If you have thoughts, commentary you would like to share, go ahead and get your hand up. Do not wait until the last minute. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. Feel free to share your thoughts, observations.
Probably heard.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to say, great read again. Hotel Teresa shows up again in another book. You know, he said whites were fools on page 32. Whites were fools, and one had constantly to fight in order not to underestimate their power and danger, because a powerful and dangerous fool is not to be underestimated. Now, I don't think white people are fools. I just want to say I didn't agree with that. Let's see what else I have here. This reminded me of my grandmother. On page 37, he said she never wore red before. she had been told all her life that she could not, because she was too dark, too black. But Freeman had told her that she should wear it because she was the homie queen. My grandmother was very dark skinned, and she would not wear red for anything in the world. She would always say that she was too black to wear red. And I guess that was common. I always wondered why she said that, so it was interesting when I heard that in the book. I think that white woman brushing her breast up against him was practicing, you know, this standard. And I also think that agent showed their sexual perversion. I have one more section here. Where he's talking about the senators, and this is the senator that got him the position. That came up with the great idea that in order to get the Negro vote, it was better to put him in there. And he said, he knew the rest of the group had flunked out. But as long as there's one Negro, the CIA was integrated. And I think that goes for white mentality as well. As long as they have one black with that one token there, they feel like everything is just fine. They can always say, oh, I have a one black friend, or you know, I have a black grandchild or a black nephew or something. It's just, as long as they have that one, you know, that proves they're not racist. And I'll mute my line, thank you.
Right on. Make sure. The caller at 5993. I don't think we've heard from you. 5993. Did you have commentary?
Yes. I missed the book reading. I'm just not getting off of work, but I wanted to say that I watched the movie today for the first time, and it actually reminded me of the Turner Diaries, when we read the Turner Diaries. And it was like the black version of the Turner Diaries, I guess, because, you know, in the Turner Diaries, it was the same kind of scenario, but with the white guys on the other side of the situation. And I'm in my line. That's all I wanted to say.
Oh, right on. You mentioned that as one of the other bits of fiction that we have read over the years. The caller at 0997, did you have comments here?
Yes, sir. Good evening. I just wanted to say, I was like 13 years old when I read this book in 69, 70. And what I always got from it, he was a subversive. He didn't want to bring any attention on himself. He exuded confidence with his excellence in how he approached everything. He was actually the proverbial spook that sat by the door, invisible in the room, but he made himself invisible. He refused to partake of trivial things as most of his peers did, because he had a greater agenda. He was preparing himself for something even bigger. And that's as far as I go, because I don't want to get in front of the book. I read it many, many years ago. But at the same time, in that same era, they had books like Donald Goins. They had many pretty good books back then, fiction. But thank you. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks who dialed in, I think we got all the folks we have not heard from. Other folks who dialed in who have commentary, feel free.
Can we hear?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this section was really great as far as his codification. There was a section on page 35 where Mr. Greenlee writes, he says, tell you something about that man. This is the female prostitute who the agent is asking questions about, Mr. Freeman. Tell you something about that man, though. People don't give him no shit. He moved quiet, don't say nothing, but I seen some bad cats move around him. This cat owed me the bread. You don't want to pay it. I don't tell him nothing about what you say his name, Freeman. I don't say nothing about him being my man. I just took him there before we make it to the hotel, and maybe he wants some action. I get a cut. The cat owed me. Cat who owed me start to get a little off the wall about the bread. Then he looked at Freeman. He's just standing there watching the crap game, quiet, ain't bothering nobody. But this cat owes me the bread. Look at him. And then look at me, and baby, he gave me the bread. And that cat, one of the baddest men in D.C. He made two of Freeman, but he don't want no part of him. He ain't my man, and it wasn't his scene. But I thought about it, and if I had trouble, that he might that he that night, TV in it. He ain't romantic about chicks on the block. Never comes on like a social worker. How a nice girl like you get into this shit? Let me take you out of it, baby. None of that shit. I'm the whore, and he knows it, but he treats me like a queen. I think he putting me on for a long time, and then I get to like it. He can put me on as long as he wants. I dig the way he treats me. I'm a whore. He knows it. I know it. But when I'm with him, he makes me feel like a queen. And I just found that telling because Freeman is the type of person who can be around probably some of the most dangerous people on the street level, but yet can also be in the room with white people who are so-called educated and supposedly, I would call them high-end whites as far as them being in the CIA and the things that they are exposed to. So that says a lot for his malleability, which is something that's very, very special to be able to be in such diverse circles and be able to be respected and have that sort of impact as far as just him, the way he was carrying himself in that room. And I really found that to be interesting. And when the agent kept asking about his sexual habits and asked if he was gay or had any sort of really outlandish sexual behaviors, I noticed that the prostitute kept speaking of the white man, if that's what he was into, she could, you know, basically put him in contact with what he was looking for. And I've always felt just from life experience and from studying and researching white people and how they function, that white men are either homosexual, highly effeminate, and they'll be bisexual, or they're just effeminate. And I think she really calls that out as a prostitute who's had numerous experiences with white people. She seems to have that understanding that they're naturally deviant, and she tries to play on that to try and make a little bit of extra money. So I found that interesting, and also his fascination with his sexual habits kind of is a Dr. Wealthy moment, in the sense that they're always fascinated with trying to turn us into images of themselves as far as that deviant behavior and trying to normalize it. So I found that to be very interesting. Also, at the beginning of Chapter 4, he writes, each morning Freeman would drive his secondhand Corvair to the big building, descend three levels, unlock the door of his office, and begin to work. He ate in the cafeteria just often enough not to appear aloof. The rest of the time, he would bring his own lunch in his briefcase and eat in his windowless room, listening to rhythm and blues or jazz from the Negro radio station in Washington on a transistor radio. And I found that telling because we just talked about that in workplace racism, appearing aloof, which means that you don't fit into whatever white environment that you might be in on the plantation. And he had a conscious awareness about not being aloof or looking aloof to them, but still remaining codified. And his codification in regards to the way he carried himself at lunch. A lot of these things you want to implement when you start a job, not as you become codified and you're in a job, because white people watch us closely. And I think that he's giving a lot of insight into how we can function and should function around white people. And I'll just stop there and give someone else a chance to speak. I did have a couple other things, but I'll let someone else go. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir. I wanted to ask, would this be posted up tonight on the archives?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. This is, I'm talking to a male, correct? Just making sure.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, right on. My bad. Sorry about that, sir.
No
yes,
problem.
It'll be in the archives. It should be within maybe an hour, hour and a half, I think it takes generally, to post. If you go to iTunes, it should refresh, or wherever else you listen. It'll be at Black Talk Radio Network. The archives will be there as well. It should be within, I would say, an hour or so of the program ending.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. Other folks have comments they wanted to make sure they got in?
May I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you, sir. Looks like he might have got disconnected. Grab him as if he dials back in and share. Other folks have commentary? Anybody that we have not heard from have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Yes, may I be here?
Yes, sir.
I'm referring to the section where Freeman was talking to the senator, and the senator was asking him about, you know, some of the problems in juvenile delinquency and crime, and how just how Freeman was responding to him, and then trying to, you know, integrate or introduce, you know, some of the other problems at the same time, that hoping that, you know, maybe the senator would consider this, but, and all the time the senator was just considering a speech, you know. And I guess we have to mention that sexual oppression or sexual terrorism is part of racism, white supremacy. And then I wanted to comment, after Freeman was talking to the senator, I guess he was promoted, and it said Freeman was appointed the next week as special assistant to the director. He was given a glass enclosed office in the director's suite. His job was to be black and conspicuous as the integrated Negro of the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America. And then that's kind of ironic, because it's like brilliant to think that, you know, now you just put yourself in probably the worst position you could possibly be in. And then now they're going to put the pressure on you by some white female brushing up against you while you are some token, you know, in the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm Luke Klein. Thanks for taking the call, guys.
For sure, for sure. I didn't see the other caller that got disconnected dial back in. If the person, I think it was 1902, if you have commentary, you should just dial back in, raise your hand, and I'll get you on the line. Other folks have commentary? Anybody that we missed have commentary? They wanted to make sure they got in. I'll assume we got all the folks. Wow, during the second audio segment, some of the things that stood out. The whole scene, the bar scene, where the agent comes in and he's going to investigate Freeman. He's going to talk to the prostitute to see if he can get some background information on him. That scene is in the movie, but it does not play out in exactly the same manner. It is a very different proposition, the way that they do things in the movie. I think in the movie, he goes, it's a white guy, he goes, he asks questions, you know, do you know anything about him? You know, is he into any sort of homosexual activity, blah, blah, blah. But the whole sexual thing does not play out in the movie, where she ends up noticing that, hey, he's getting aroused by all of this and I can make a few dollars off of him in the process. That does not happen in the film. If folks have any thoughts on why that aspect may have been left out, you can feel free to comment on that as we go. I thought the portion that Thomas mentioned about the female, she's a sex worker. She says that she didn't wear red because she was too dark, and all of this that plays out a little differently in the film, but it's pretty close to the same thing. It reminded me of Dr. Yaba Blay. She's been a guest on the program before, and she as well has talked about being a darker complexion, highly melanated black female, and how that you hear that same type of thing. You're not supposed to wear red. colors that you're not supposed to wear because it doesn't look good on you as a dark complexion black female. So to hear that in the book, apparently this has been something that's long running, one of the ways that we're terrorized in terms of perceptions of beauty, being a black person. But that reminded me of that and just black self-respect. Dr. Wilson said that over and over again, black self-respect, and doing Dan Freeman's character, doing what he can to help this black female feel that, yes, I am beautiful the way that I am, and having some pride in myself. That obviously that was a huge theme of what was taking place during this time period, the late 1960s going on into the 1970s. Certainly that was a huge aspect of what was happening at the time. Let's see, some of the other things that stood out. The whole thing with the senator, this is, I guess, most of chapter four, at least for me, just really showcasing the incident, what I said before about not having correct intentions with the senator. I don't even care. I've already got the Negro votes that I need. I'm chilling. I don't care if all of them fail or if none of them make it or whatever. Like, this is, you know, I have no sincere interest in any of this. I think that's standard operating procedure under the system of white supremacy. I thought it was really well written, the humor that goes into a lot of this, where Senator Hennington is saying that he's found that in talking to black people, if you can say Mr. a lot, or presumably Mrs., that it makes the conversation better. I think that might even go to what some of what Thomas was talking about yesterday in terms of white validation, where whites, where they want to come and be able to talk to a black person and make that black person feel like, oh my gosh, this, you know, cool white man or cool white woman is, you know, coming to hang out with me, and I feel so much better about myself and life, and, you know, this is just amazing. And when you don't give into that, but it seems that the senator has caught on, like, oh, I can do that. If I just call them Mr., they will think I'm great, and, you know, we'll have a grand old time if I call them Mrs., that sort of thing. And then you get the reverse, where Freeman says, I found talking to whites. If you just keep saying sir, that you get a whole different conversation. I think that sort of thing continues as well. I know Mr. Fuller said that he would call black males and females sir, ma'am. He noted that also tended to upset whites, where they wanted to be the only ones that thought of in that sort of respected, dignified manner. Let's see, I thought the phrasing that he used, culturally deprived, this is the senator talking to Freeman, culturally deprived, that sounds like one of the code words that whites, they make up new ones as they go. Sometimes it'll be culturally deprived, underserved, urban, lots of different little code words that they come up for talking about victims of white supremacy, particularly black people. Another Dr. Welsing moment when they're talking, and he says, the problem of increased illegitimate pregnancies among the youth of culturally deprived. I certainly don't take the extreme stand of those who advocate sterilization, but advice concerning birth control devices should be made available, and in some cases they should be provided. That is Dr. William Shockley. I think this book was published, I think this might have been a little bit before. I think a lot of the information about Planned Parenthood was known, but I certainly think at this time you had Dick Gregory and others who, they had some understanding that whites are trying to keep us from procreating. I think there was it was either Ebony or Jet magazine cover at that time where Dick Gregory was saying, you know, black people should have more children. Whites are trying to make sure that we're not procreating, that we're not producing more black babies. So certainly there's some level, but I think these sterilization programs that were happening in different states, North Carolina, California, I think they were still rolling at the time that this book was published. So that is even, you know, more cringeworthy. Let's see. Oh, and just FYI, that used to be a term. Spook Who Sat by the Door used to be a term for racial showcasing. Apparently, 50 years ago, blacks had enough of an understanding to see that you could hire a black person and just put, as he writes in the book, and put them up front, put them in an office, and put them in a conspicuous position to make sure that they will be seen. So people say, oh my gosh, you're integrated, you have a Negro.
working here, that used to be a term that was used to describe racial showcasing, and then he lays it out in detail. Great, we'll give him a job to make sure that everyone can see him. It sounds like Mr. Fuller could have done this and just put in racial showcasing instead of spook by the door. Let's see, anything else? I'll stop there. Folks have any thoughts on why the scene, I mean, because I think that's a substantial difference where when he goes, the white CIA agent, he's going to get background information on Freeman and Snoop to find out, you know, what he's into. And they leave out his sexual perversions and the black female being able to make some money off of him. Any thoughts on why that scene may have been left out or any other observations folks want to make sure they get in before we conclude things? No one.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just looked it up real quick. So the film was distributed by United Artists. I mean, for all we know, that part was in the original when they took it out. Or, you know, they were told, hey, you know, you're not going to show none of that. This film came out in 1973. You know, we don't want to see that, you know, in this movie, you know. You know, that it wasn't time for that yet. I think it would have been possible. I mean, they attempted to put this out in major theaters. That would have definitely been something that would have, I mean, if the content alone wasn't a turnoff, that would have been the ultimate, I think, in 1973. I could be wrong because I wasn't born yet, but that's what I'm thinking.
Anything else there, not, or folks satisfied, stood out from the second audio segment, or anything that you missed from the first audio segment, or if you want to respond to that question about why that was not included in the film?
Yes, I did have one thing I wanted to speak about from the second reading, but can you just repeat the question for me?
Just the scene where this white CIA agent, he ends up, he is sexually aroused by all of this, and this is what he's into. This is his form of sexual deviance. That scene is not in the film. The CIA agent just questions her about Freeman, and that's that. It doesn't get, you know, anything sexual with him and the black female. Folks have thoughts on why that was not included in the film.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was not included in the movie because of, I think that either... Because I know Sam Greenlee was under a lot of pressure because of what the content of the movie was, because it was showing black self-respect and showing black people a visual example of what codification should look like when we're functioning with white people. But I'm sure that it was nixed from the movie either because United Artists, when they were facilitating, I guess, the cutting of the film, or maybe Sam Greenlee might have codified that, understanding that maybe if he showed that sort of deviance, he might have gotten even more negative attention. But essentially, they wanted to, I believe, if it was done by United Artists, it was done in order to make black people look like we're deviant and to not show the true deviance, which is white pathology, psychosexual pathology, and behavior. So I think it was just a way of trying to make black people look like we are the ones who are always involved in some sort of either criminal or deviant activity, and the white people are supposed to look like they're not involved in those things by them not even showing those sorts of things. So I think that's my feelings about it. I have a feeling that it's either Mr. Greenlee's codification, or when white people got their hands on the film, that was their choice to remove that from the film so that they could in turn practice racism in cutting this black man's film. I do remember I had a friend of mine who lived in my building in Jersey City. He's from Detroit, an older gentleman, and we actually watched the movie because I have it on DVD, so we watched it at his house one day, and he had told me that when he saw it, he was a child, and when he saw it in Detroit, he said it was in the theaters for less than a week. He said, I think it might have been 3 or 4 days max, and then they, like, literally removed it from the theaters because, obviously, they don't want black people to see ourselves in a position where we're functioning in a counter-racist manner that is just as codified and clandestine as whites do to us every day. The section in the book I wanted to touch on was on page 42, where Mr. Greenlee writes, oh, but you are, everyone says, what a good job you're doing. This is the white woman who's brushing her nasty breasts on him every so often, sexually terrorizing him. The good job you're doing, much better than anyone ever expected. You know I'm ambitious, too. I don't want to be a secretary all my life. I've applied for a lateral entry into the officer's corps, and if I pass the oral exams next year, I'll get an overseas assignment. I'm sure you'll pass. The elevator arrived, and they entered it. And I just found that interesting because I found that statement to be a double entendre. Because when he made the statement about her being so young and making it to the position that she made with being an accomplishment, there was an undercurrent of her screwing her way to that position. And there, when she talked about her oral exams, I thought of the same thing. It was like a double entendre of her using sex and her so-called beauty to move her way up in the ranks to get to where she needs to be. So I found that to be telling. And then also, when she said to him, you're doing much better than anyone ever expected. So even she's saying, we didn't expect you to get that far, nigger, but you're doing way better than we expected. And because she's sexually attracted to him, she wants to make sure that she lets him know that the, you know, master thinks you're doing well. And of course, I do too. So I just found that to be very telling. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
That is another subtle difference in the film. I thought that was a great point as well about the sexual double entendres that are happening within that passage, but that is not in the film either. You do see the scene where the white woman questions Freeman and you're ambitious and blah, 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 but unless I missed it, I don't think there's the breast rub is there. I don't think there's any sexual play going on between those two in the film. She just comes and says that they want you to do the tour. You're ambitious. You're the best section chief that we've had, and then they move on to the tour, if you want to watch it again to make sure. But I don't think there's anything sexual there in the film. Any last comments? Folks want to make sure they get in? Folks satisfied? Anything else folks want to make sure they get in?
Yeah, I just wanted to
What you just said. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just want to piggyback on what Rod said, because I also heard from various people that this only lasted 2 weeks in the movie theater in Times Square. And it was sold out every night, but it only lasted 2 weeks. And I heard the same thing about in Jersey as well. It only lasted 2 weeks or 3 weeks in Newark. So I just thought that was very compelling. It was the only other movie that I've seen recently that only had a short shelf life. It seemed to also deal with codification, which is, I know you don't like the movie too much, Dustin, which is Goodbye Uncle Tom, which lasted 1 week in Times Square. And it was out the country after 1 week because the content of the movie, which I think would have woke black people up. And I put my line. Thank you.
I didn't like the movie Goodbye Uncle Tom. I don't remember saying I had something against that movie.
I think you said it was too gruesome to see it, something like that. You know, to watch it was gruesome.
It is gruesome, but I definitely wouldn't say it's.
I could be wrong. I'm sorry if I damn.
I don't want. Roz.
Oh, I was just going to say what you presented about them not showing the sexual terrorism of this white creature, female creature, is very telling as well, because remember, the black man is supposed to lust after the white woman, not the other way around. They're not supposed to show the women that they don't really put on the pestle. They falsely do so using rhetorical ethic anyway. They're not going to ever want to show a white woman, especially at that time, coming on to a black man in a sexual way, especially being sexually aggressive. And this goes back to, reminds me of Delectable Negro again, basically hiding and obfuscating, to take your term, excuse me, Gus, essentially obfuscating the fact that white women are like the original terrorists, especially in a clandestine way, and the sorts of things that they do sexually to basically terrorize black males and black females for that matter. So I found that to be a telling point as well, because you did point that out, and it is accurate. They don't show that in the movie at all. Thank you.
For sure.
Hey, Gus, I would like to say one more thing about the white woman. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, I wanted to make a comment about the question that Gus posed. I think that if the system of white supremacy allows victims to make a connection between the sexual terrorism and racism, white supremacy, then, you know, that would be an intricate part of enlightening their minds. So you don't want to, you know, give them any indication of what we're doing to you, and especially the black female. So that's my take on it. I mute my line.
Very interesting. Very interesting. That is pretty much our 3 hours. If you have additional comments that you want to get in, you can feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, and we'll share it as we go. Again, this book is not very long. I cannot imagine us being on this book longer than 5, maybe 6 sessions, but even that is a little much for me. I think we're going to be able to wrap this up pretty quickly. So stay tuned. Should be great. You can watch the film again as you go. That way you can kind of compare and contrast. It's been my experience, though, as I said, a lot more people have seen the movie as opposed to having read the book. So hopefully this will be great for everyone to be more informed and just appreciate the brilliance of Mr. Greenlee. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Pacific, or 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tomorrow, that would be Saturday evening. We'll be here on Sunday as well, the Sunday Global Talk on Racism, White Supremacy. That is the early broadcast, 12 Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, Saturday in the daytime. Be great to hear from our folks outside the states. We'll be here on Monday. Dr. Tommy Curry will be back with us. That's Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And we'll be here next Wednesday as well. So just stay tuned. We should be on the next, I guess, what is that, three consecutive days. We'll be on. If you have questions, observations, thoughts, commentary, feel free. We'll be looking forward to hearing suggestions or thoughts, commentary as we roll. With that, again, sobriety would be best for victims of white supremacy. Had some drinking scenes in the flick this week, in the book this week as well. One of the worst combinations in the universe, alcohol, whites. You never know, particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle, you never know when it will be your day to bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, race soldier, badge or no. We should take it seriously. Being in a system of white supremacy at all times, we are in danger. Things could, you never know when things could take a drastic turn and end up being in a life-altering, life-ending situation. Take it seriously and be sober. That is the best way I think we can make phenomenal decisions to keep ourselves safe. With that, thanks again for tuning in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.